I'm your half a host, Gareth Stack.
And I'm your other half, James Van der Waal.
Welcome to Reading Place. This is the second episode of our new series where we discuss a play. Today's play is The Lonesome West by Martin McDonagh. We might as well explain the show, which is just that we talk about a play. It's like a book club, but for plays. You can read the play at home. Join us on our journey through the dramatic world of The Lonesome West. It's part of the Connemara trilogy, along with The Beauty Queen of Lenan and A Skull in Connemara. This is a play which revitalised Irish theatre in the late 1990s to the chagrin of some traditionalists. It was originally published in 1997 by Methuen Drama and first performed June 11th at the Druid Theatre in Galway in cooperation with London's Royal Court Theatre, because while Martin McDonagh has an Irish name and indeed writes on Irish matters, he is, in fact, English. Oh. Well, he's got a Cockney accent. He calls himself Irish. But anyway.
Did you say that with a bit of a Cockney accent as you were saying it? He's got a bit of a Cockney accent.
Yeah. Gripping bow bells. The play was hugely successful. It went to Broadway in 1999, where it was nominated for Tony for Best Play and Best Actor. And it was one of... Martin McDonagh, at one point in the late 90s, had apparently more plays on in the West End at the same time than anyone except for Shakespeare in the history of theatre. So instantly was he a hit, and he made all these interesting claims at the time. He said he'd never read any plays and that he wrote this play in 3 weeks, and
interesting lies.
Yeah, some of which are extremely dubious. This play is set in the same world of the other plays in the Connemara trilogy, which is I suppose it's a kind of a post-apocalyptic town, in the sense that the apocalypse has been the destruction of the mythological Irish West, and its explication on stage in particular. So for me, anyway, this play represents very much the imaginary world of the stage after the death of the traditional myth of Irish theatre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a postmodern aspect to it. In fact, it even the way the set direction has been written, it's initially trying to set up that great, you know, mise-en-scene, as they put it, which is this, like, look at this classic Irish enculturated house full of, like, rustic setups. The floors are tarnished. There's a rake on the wall. There's a shotgun. Yeah. But actually, all of those things just end up being perversions as part of these two characters who we'll get into.
And
now. They're
hilarious as well. I mean, one of the first stage directions is there's a literal picture of a black dog on the wall.
Yeah, there is. A black dog.
Which is, you know, obviously it's a reference to depression, but it's when you literalize, it's a fantastic,
it's
simplistic form of humor.
Also, I quite liked the shotgun being described as just being below the crucifix on the wall.
Heavy-handed symbolism. But one of the best things about these plays, I mean, we'll get into this later, is that they were interpreted in America as being these kind of very serious depictions of Irish, the misery of modern Irish cultural life and the desperation of people left, which they're completely not at all. Mm. They're ludicrously over-the-top, Tarantino-esque orgies of violence and sex. And the fact that this was misperceived so heinously is hilarious and speaks to the credulity of the American critic.
The two central characters of the brothers are the people who have this strong, let's call it a little bit dynamically influenced. In other words, they have extreme dynamism and strength and a lot of background images and a willingness to be very violent in a way that most humans wouldn't. They're the risen Eros. They're like the crazy part of the play that's frenetic and that you watch it for. That's the part where that's the extension of belief there. I find the characters around them aren't, though.
I think you're absolutely right.
I think there's a reality tinged around them. They're the setup for hilarity of this bleak Western modern Ireland, just hinting on death, and everything around it is just resolution with crime is everywhere, there is no God, jurisdiction is in nothing. In fact, the line later on, which is God has no jurisdiction here, becomes prevalent because you have a character who's sitting as the surrogate of the audience, which is the priest. By the way, I should mention the characters. Should we get into that now?
Let's get into the characters, because I think you made a really good point, which is, I was being very flippant, but when you first read the play, it's kind of rip-roaring, hilarious misadventure and very dark humour. But when you read it the second time, it's very clear that this character of Father Welch is...
Walsh,
as he's referred to, misnamed throughout the play, is the heart and soul of the play. He is the kind of the serious lesson, and he is the character that embodies the real pain that all of this humor is masking for the audience.
He's the audience's surrogate. He's the moral accountant. He's a lot of these things. Because without him, there would be nothing to bounce off this crazy relationship with the brothers.
And when I initially read it, I kind of took that as being ironic, wholly kind of over the top. But reading it a second time, I think it isn't purely comedic and it isn't purely ironic, and there actually is a dread to it and a truthfulness about the sexual extremists and absence and the pain of it. And he is kind of the cathexis for all
Thixis,
that stuff.
Very nice, yes.
Othixis.
Cathexis.
It's Thinsis, actually. So there's only four characters. We've got Girlene, the
wonderfully named.
The not particularly well-developed young girl.
Whose secret name is Mary, not so secret.
Titillating Girlene.
Mm-hmm. He's 17, she's a schoolgirl. You have the Welsh Walsh, who's actually Welsh, and his first name is what again? Something weird.
Father.
Yeah, there we go. Yes, the priest.
Oh, it's, yeah, what is it? It's Rombusius or...
He has a really odd...
Rupert
or
something.
Rupert, an odd or name. Yeah,
Rupert, I think. And we have the two brothers. We have Coleman, who I believe is the older brother. It's never actually stated, but kind of implied.
Valine.
And Valine, which is almost
oddly
like a name
named
from Chekhov.
Yeah, it's an oddly named Irish character. Possibly deliberately making references, not just to Chekhov, but to... no, actually, I can't. I had another name in mind there.
To Vaseline. Out.
Yes, that sounds slightly Russian at one point. Yeah.
I'm sure it makes reference to something very clever that I didn't pick up on.
Yeah, Mayakovsky, I was going to say, but it's there are certain aspects of this play we should just establish that are clearly making reference to other plays, even though he claimed to have never read other plays. And there's definitely, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but there's and this is something that scorns a lot of Irish playwrights because they don't want to the comparison because he's so omnipotent and everywhere when it comes to the influences, but Beckett is a little bit teetering into how the dialogue was written here, just a little bit. It can't, not just because I'm projecting the influence, it's quite direct. But other than that, I thought there was a real originality to how they discursively discuss, quite punitively and horribly, the problems of their life almost immediately without it being boring. Because they're stating the obvious, but it's very natural stating the obvious. And the event justifies it, which is, I should explain to the audience, it opens up on two brothers and the priest arriving back from the funeral of the two brothers' father, who's just been mistakenly shot in the head.
Accidentally shot terminally wounded.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's how we join them in scene one. After the funeral of their father, who has, I've written in brackets here, he's died under dubious circumstances.
Yeah.
We meet the Coleman brothers and, the Coleman brothers. I'm thinking of Coleman's mayonnaise.
Coleman's mustard, I was going
to
say.
It's a lot of sleep deprivation. Sorry, the two brothers, centrals of the play, I guess they're Connor. Yeah, the Connor brothers. Mm-hmm. Valine, who's described as a money-grubbing,
miser
with no heart at all.
Yeah.
And his kind of vicious, psychopathic brother.
Impulsive brother.
Coleman.
Yeah.
So do you want to walk us through scene one?
Do I? Would be privileged. Yes, absolutely. I definitely want to, especially since I've been asked. Okay, so it actually opens with Welsh and Coleman first, and they enter the scene and... the setup is, it tells you that the kind of set direction is that there's two doors. There's one door for the room on the left for one of the brothers, and the other door just right across from them on the left, as if to say there's like they're on the same side of the room. You have the crucifix, the shotgun, the picture of the dog, and you're told that there's a lot of saints in saint figurines in miniature toy form that are covered in dust, telling you that they've never been touched. They've just been collected, which is kind of sets things up beautifully. And then enters Coleman with the priest, and they start a kind of a dry conversation where the priest is trying to invect or trying to suggest that Coleman must be feeling lonely or some sort of reaction to the death of his father, of which Coleman is kind of obfuscating and throwing away and kind of being misdirected by with his cynicism, just saying things like, not really, if you say so, playing to the kind of righteousness of a priest, which gives you this idea that Welsh or Walsh, depending how you pronounce it, is just this, when not drunk, self-righteous, contemptible priest trying to throw on his adjudicated sense of Catholicism onto people because he wants to proselytize. But actually, that very quickly, even in the first scene, you start to realize that he's just trying to make these two brothers react.
And this is a great way to introduce this kind of absence that they show, an absence of humanity and empathy. And even later in the play, when they begin to show empathy, it's very quickly revealed to be the shallow empathy of a monster. You know, and this absence is going to be compensated for by Father Welch's humanity and a surfeit of humanity, which is going to do for him in the end.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it what should be a kind of an analysis that's put onto Coleman, initially starting with questions like, are you not feeling lonely? You'll be lonesome, focusing on the lonely word and the idea of this abyss that is, you know, a man without his father, and trying to engage him about, well, how do you feel about your brother? And all that Coleman is complaining about is, well, you know, half the people there were just fucking asking about the Volavons and the reception, those pricks. And he hates the fact that everyone there didn't really know his father and they were just trying to beg him for, you know, use some sort of after service, because an Irish wake, particularly in the West Country, is so traditionally a riotous affair full of free food and drink. And he was just pissed off that there wasn't any of that anyway. So he's pissed off, one, that people are asking for it, but two, that his brother was too cheap, who's, as he puts it, holding the purse strings to give it to him. So then the analysis switches back around, where all of a sudden the priestess starts to actually self-reflexively talking about himself, saying, why am I no good? But he gets, as they put it, maudlin. He's getting maudlin again. And he starts talking about how he's ineffective, or he seems to be ineffectual at trying to get at these people.
And not only that, but he's quite clearly told by Coleman what a terrible priest he is. And but at least he's not a paedophile. He's got that going for him.
Yeah, exactly. He's told, like, well, you're not touching kids like every other priest around. So you got that.
So fair play, you know.
And you're coaching the under-12s team, which is something that becomes the only material worth that these brothers can see, and the town can see, from the priest, which is he coaches the under-12s girls team. And
there's a great series of jokes about the venomous behaviour on the pitch of this under-12s girls soccer team, who variously put other players into comas and paralysed them and killed them on the pitch. And and he refers to later in the play, you know, those bitches never listened to a word I said anyway.
But they see it as strikingly horrible that he left them, which we'll get to that later.
Yeah, so that's then we get the arrival of Gurleen.
Yeah.
The Gurleen. Love interest.
Well, actually, it's the brother comes in first, which is Valeen. Did I just mispronounce his name again? It's Valeen, isn't it?
Valeen, yes.
Yeah, Valeen enters, and much to the prediction of Coleman, who was drinking the putchian that wasn't his, because we feel he's definitely the one who has less things in this family of an already, a family who has a drought of any real material other than Christian figurines, drink, and tato crisps. And he enters and, of course, acknowledges that you're drinking my putchian, of which Coleman starts saying, well, I wasn't going to refuse the priest a drink. And they both then have a bit of a laugh at the fact that the priest has clearly got alcoholic... he's got alcoholic tendencies. And the priest is still trying to turn the analysis back onto them, this time going to Valeen, saying, you know, how do you feel about your father? And Valeen just turns to miserly things. Subjects of, like, well, why are you drinking my putchine? How dare you could do this to me? Because he's more obsessed.
There's a great moment. Gurleen arrives. It's after she arrives, but she gives him a check, which is his inheritance. And he literally rubs it in the face of his brother. The play is full of these great moments, because literalism is one of my favourite kinds of humour. It's really stupid, but it always makes me literally laugh. Mm-hmm. that was a literal groan there. But we have all these moments where someone's doing something which is so allegorical and so obviously metaphorical that it's just silly.
And also screaming whatever the secret metaphor, secret source is, which is right in front of you, which is this guy has agreed with this guy to, and as we conclude by the end of scene one, to hide the fact that Coleman, in another act of impulsiveness that he can't control, killed his father, witnessed by Valeen. Valeen played against him as a witness, saying, if you allow me, if I say you never committed this act, it was an accident, you give me the entirety of his inheritance. And he's already waving in the face of the audience and of Coleman here, saying, look how much, and makes him acknowledge it, because they have a lot of which is EH question mark, which is their way of going, hey, huh? And he keeps pointing, going, huh? I have the money, right? Acknowledge it.
This revelation of the murder is so blasé.
Right, it's right at the end going, I'm glad we didn't tell him because he'd be right pissed off. As they're referring to the priest.
The priest and Gurleen, the putchin sales lady, have left, and the brother's just sort of, sure, good thing he doesn't know that you shot our father.
Because he'd be really pissed about it.
He'd be pretty annoyed. He takes these things quite seriously. he's really an old footy-duddy.
Yeah.
And again, revealing their callousness and how brutalized they've become. They've been made by their environment.
They are definitely, to go back to this word I know you hate me using, but they are definitely the spectral creatures of extreme repressed demons of, like, urges to kill, lust, and misunderstanding of objects. There's nothing that you could say is a defined human substantive element to them, especially at the start, where they just seem to be people who get off on people's misery, including one another, and can only see the world through the veil of money. Putchine. So it's just drink, money, and misery, which is definitely the currency that reappears throughout the plays, and in fact shows up in other plays by McDonagh. The Irish currency of the West is, if like especially in poverty, is money, drink, and how miserable you are.
And also how, and it's very pointed in this play, but how families are trapped together by financial considerations and just by the prison of the culture for far longer than is healthy. And daughter, in The Beauty Queen of Lanann, we have a daughter staying into adulthood with her aging mother. Mm. And here we have two brothers who are, we should mention, I suppose it's never explicitly said, but I presume they're in their 40s or 50s at least, and they've lived together their whole
potentially
lives.
Sexually have never had any activity either.
Well, that comes into play in the next couple of scenes.
It does, yeah.
The beautiful cleanliness of the brothers' souls, because of course they've never engaged in any sexual activity,
which I like. Only insofar as that the suggested beauty that comes being a virgin there is another mockery of the Catholic Church's deep misunderstanding of human nature.
Well, one of the things that's quite interesting about the play, I only realised it earlier talking with my girlfriend about it, is that every character in the play is a virgin. Mm-hmm. We've got Gurleen, who we learn is more virtuous than she implies with her constantly flirtatious dialogue, and mm-hmm. she's very flirtatious with Father Welch in this scene, which
comes
into play later.
In fact, she's suggestively in love with him.
Well, that that's revealed later.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
Surprise.
And we've got Father Welch, obviously a priest, presumably a virgin. And we've got these two brothers who we later discover are sad virgin gay boys.
Who both actually destroy the opportunities of the other.
That's a direct quote, by the way. I mean, it's not a homophobic ramble.
Yeah, they consistently refer to each other as gay boys.
Virgin gay
because
boys.
Because what Gareth wanted to say was baddie boys, but he didn't say it.
Baddie boys.
Baddie boys.
Oh, baddie boys. Yeah. That wouldn't have even
it's
occurred
Jamaican
to me.
Jamaican slang, right?
I don't have the same hatred in my heart that you do.
Oh, very good.
So scene two, another argument between the brothers. And these arguments continue all through the play. These bickerings over nothing, over crisps, over stolen poutine. The difference between Tato and, is it Walker?
McCoy's, actually.
McCoy,
yeah.
The quality of McCoy and the rivulets that they have
in
them.
It has curves, he puts it. Grooves.
So this is they're arguing over drink and possibly the theft of money, because it's an allegation that that the subservient Coleman hasn't been putting in the house insurance money, and then Coleman makes this claim that he's fooled around with Gurleen, that she wanted to touch him down there. Mm-hmm. and
this is you've moved on to scene two though, haven't
this
you?
Is scene two, scene
yes,
two,
yes. She established that it's moved on to scene two just to get a grip.
I did say that,
did you?
Yes.
Well, just now. Sorry.
You were probably listening to something you'd said in your head earlier and enjoying it.
It was a better part of the show, definitely. Okay.
This is going to take so much editing. So there's this claim made by Coleman that he has encountered Gurleen sexually. And so credulous is his brother that he just says, you know, what did it feel like? Yeah. Was it good to have the
when he touched you down there, as he refers to it.
Lizzie Coleman says that she loves an older man. So she goes for
she likes the old lads.
She likes an old virgin man who lives with his brother. That's what she's into. And they come to blows over the theft of a packet of Tato. Mm-hmm. And Father Welch interrupts again, coming between them, literally. Coming between this conflict between this Cain and Abel primeval conflict, with news of a tragic event. Tom Hanlon, a local policeman, has been drowned. He's drowned himself.
He's walked into a lake
up to his head,
and drowned himself.
Which is almost as quite a mythic.
It's a very mythic.
Is
death.
It possible
it's a poignant
to
image
walk
about
into a lake?
Not really, but the idea is that it's suggestive of disappearing. It's evaporating yourself out of existence and walking into the abyss of, you know, what was a representative of emotions and being destroyed and your identity being evaporated.
And of course it connects into all this Celtic symbolism of the lady in the lake, of the
lady
children
in the lake,
of Lear.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Return to the lake, the place of mysticism, but also the place of great energy, you know, the original force of man.
And drowning
in this case.
And so they resume squabbling despite this tragic event. They don't really care. Their only reaction is to sort of decry some minor thing that the policeman did to them many years ago. And Father Welch cracks and you know, just loses control and leaves. And I think he's pursued by... Oh, yeah, he leaves with Verlaine eventually.
Verlaine catches up with him, promising to help him
fish the body
out of the water.
And so trivial are the concerns of Coleman that he takes this as the opportunity to continue the squabble by...
Which is over a stove at this point, right?
Over a stove, yeah. So there's a precious stove, which is another... This staging is fantastic. And there's this very expensive stove that is continually referenced and lauded by Verlaine. He just loves this precious, this symbolic item that he owns. So he takes all of his religious figurines, places them in a bucket or something like this, puts it in the stove and turns it on to gas Mark 9 or 10,
which is also a point of contention that he used it all up the gas.
That he's been using the gas when it wasn't really needed. And this kind of, like all of this is kind of very trivial stuff, but it's, I'm picturing the young McDonagh, because I know he travelled to Ireland as a child, seeing this miserliness in person, because it's something that Irish people of a certain age will remember. Pre-Celtic Tiger Ireland, you had this tremendous poverty and miserliness over
the country,
food.
It's kind of always like that, even during the Celtic time.
Yeah, well, certainly it was for my family, but other people had it better. But when you go down the country, you visit older relatives, and they're kind of sitting in the cold, and they're eating the rasher, and there's only one rasher, and there's this meanness over everything, and everything is sort of envied.
Yeah, absolutely. And pleasure cannot be had unless it's had privately. God forbid someone see you enjoying something, because then there's jealousy and envy over that. Then it's discussed in some horrible dialogue, usually of pointing at the other person of not being deserved of that thing. It's a thing classic in some of Montague's poems, as well as in Philip Larkin's, or at least when Larkin briefly tipped onto that Irish element of the background of, you know, a lot of English people. And I recall this, that great quote, I think it came from Monty, which was, you know, when poverty comes through the door, love goes up the chimney. Have you ever heard that? It's really, really good.
That's good.
It's a brilliant example of what happens to a home, particularly in country Ireland, with no connections, you know, one train you're all dependent on, that sense of being just totally isolated. And with people who become sick in their isolation and then share it amongst the last of each other. And poverty just brings this cruel element where your life is measured on very specific empirical currencies, which is money and food, and that's about it. And enjoying anything is a sin, which is an odd atmosphere. And I think that bleakness is still existed even in the late 90s.
I'm sure it still exists today. I mean, yeah. Huge suicide rates to this day in rural Ireland. And it kind of reminds me about, there was a recent article in Aeon magazine about marriage counselling advice in women's magazines in the 1950s. And they're all the things you'd imagine. Yeah, the woman says, my husband...
Just let him put it up there. Just take it. Is that what it was?
Yeah, it's mostly my husband beat me in front of the children and my mother and my relatives and all the neighbors. And then they're like,
bedroom.
Why did you provoke him? Why did you provoke him?
Oh, Jesus.
But the other strand of that is that, you know, people would come to the magazine and they would say, since my husband lost his job, things have been difficult. And they would always try and emotionalize this financial difficulty. Say, well, you know, you need to deal with your emotions. This isn't about the lost job. Of course it was. Mm-hmm. I was sitting at home drinking moonshine out of a tin cup.
Finding readily that he has no other use but to print that one paper he was printing or whatever he was doing.
Yeah, the one mechanical skill that his
and
family
then
had done
utility
for 400
to distract,
years.
To distract him, he's left with his desperate wants that he can't have. And
his knuckles and his wife, that's all he's got.
Yeah.
So poverty. Yes, poverty in Ireland.
Feeling homesick now.
And yeah, there is this, you know, what I like about McDonough's work is that he is able, because he has, I think, the distance of not kind of having grown up in Ireland, he is able to have a humorous relation to the utter bleakness of Irish
rural
life.
He's a detached audience member who's able to measure on a deeper level of what's happening.
He's extrapolating it in a way that we don't see. The Irish stage eulogizes these people. Mm-hmm. If this was a play by O'Casey or Synge or something, they'd be the noble poor, you know, forced to leave or forced to live in these terrible circumstances because of the English, or if it was by Brian Friel, definitely because of the English.
Well, no, Brian Friel actually paints quite a realistic picture of the desperate countryside, and, you know, Philadelphia Here I Come in translations, which I know you don't like, does actually.
Dancing at the crossroads.
It doesn't shy away from, while nice moments are had at this young age, particularly in boyhood, where they don't have to necessarily see past their own limitations as they grow older. And usually, because if you look at Philadelphia Here I Come, it's a coming of age story as well. It's that recognition of this town has nothing. We have nothing here. We are totally obsessed with telling stories about having sex that we've never had. And without those mystical stories of even disgusting intent, that we don't have anything. Either we run to America in hopes that it's now liberal opening up 60s will save us, or there's nothing. And that's, this story deals with a similar thing, which is either we concentrate on this form of loving, which is to hate one another and to be concerned with material things that we don't even use, or what lies behind it? Death. But what lies behind the very thing that they have here, which seems disgusting, is just death. Because the countryside is bleak. There is nothing. There's a sense of constant desolation in the human soul. That's one thing I really liked about Brian Friel's work. So I want to give him a bit of defense there. I think he did tap into that part.
Let's save it for the Friel show. I know you're going to force us to do a Friel show. And it maybe that just I didn't see Friel at the right time, but the impression I always got was of this really trite blaming of colonialism for the woes of Ireland, and this celebration of hedge schools and all of these other almost fictional institutions.
Hedge schools, no. Perfect stuff.
Anyway, so moving on past my anti-Irish tirade.
No, I'm with you on Synge and other writers like that. I think they do tend to eulogise the country, living in a shack made of mud, beauty of Irish, and where they're all Gaelgore speakers and hide oral stories that none of us know. It's nonsense.
And the reason why that's so insidious is not, I mean, on one level it's fine, yeah, make a myth for a new nation, whatever, it's fine. But Ireland, for those who aren't Irish, I mean, we were a nation that was forced into protectionism after independence. So from the 30s on, we didn't trade as much as we should.
We waged an economic war with no supply.
with no point to it as well. It just purely kind of this effort to return us to a peasant nobility.
To be autarchical as well, to be self-sufficient, which was impossible, as implicitly understood from the famine, which you think you would have learned the lesson, but...
But we built some great hydroelectric generators.
We did. That no one uses. Yeah.
So moving on. So do you want to take us through scene 3?
Yes. Okay. Let me just jump on my notes to scene 3. Just want to observe one thing, though, about scene 2, which is that if you reflect on how it opened up with Valine touching and constantly checking the temperature of his stove to make sure that Coleman never used it, which just annoys Coleman, because the very acting out of testing the temperature, going, has it been used? Has it not? Is really just another way of saying, I don't trust you, which Coleman immediately is annoyed about, which causes him to then tacitly suggest he will use it, even though he never does. But they mention that Valine never has eaten from it. He's never used it to cook one thing.
That passed me by.
So there's a second observation I've taken, which is there's dusted figurines. Dusted because he doesn't clean them. He doesn't touch them. They're not for using. And then he has this stove.
What would you use a figurine for?
Well, this is the thing. Well, come on, guys. So many uses. Playing and also for shoving things.
But, hello, I'm Saint Christopher.
I'm going to fight you with the other black saint. And then they make the fight. No, but the idea is that he would at least clean them. You know, he would at least keep them maintained, because having them is, for him, is part of adoring the sainthood. But he doesn't. Why does he leave them dusted? Because it's just mere representation on a very shallow level. The stove is also representation. It's a representation of his money.
Yeah.
But also, in an odd way, it becomes this broken signifier for a kind of a lie they've both badly made, and they're not even holding on to. They both know it's a lie that they haven't killed their father, and it's just this loose thread that connects now being held in the object of a stove bought with the money from a man they murdered, and that in some way Villene knows he's helped murder, and if anything, the only bond they now have as brothers is that they've been caught in this lie. They've created a lie together, a new disgusting myth about their father in a town where everyone is being murdered anyway.
Well, this is another great aspect of McDonough's world, is that it's ludicrously violent. There's constant references to murders and suicides,
and dog's ears being chopped off,
animal cruelty of every variety,
and beyond
any kind of normal extent, which works in two levels. It's both humorous, but it also gives us this feeling that we're almost in a like a Brian O'Nolan style world of past life. It's mm-hmm. it's so grim. It's like the Western Front in World War One. It's beyond
which isn't
any
very quiet.
Ironically,
it's actually a good book.
This is a place beyond any human suffering that might even imagine. It's almost magically bleak, and its bleakness is almost magically ignored by everyone except for Father Welch.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing that might have occurred to McDonough when he arrived in Ireland as a child, was that here is a place that, compared to, you know, England at the time, in the 60s or 70s, is very grim, and yet everyone's acting as though it isn't.
It's not even that. I don't think that's quite true. In a way, they're ignorant of the misery because they don't have the will to change it or the sense of individual power. But they're aware of it insofar as they actually eulogize and celebrate misery. This is something Dylan Moran taps into his comedy, that the Irish people seem to love dramatizing their misery. They love being miserable. It's almost part of who they are, is to be miserable. Now, I don't agree with that as a mythos that should then be adapted to all Irish people. I think that we're escaping that, hopefully, and we're looking to try and get out of just being so scornful. But definitely with this town, and again to, you know, the town in Philadelphia, here I come, everyone knows they don't like being there, and everyone knows that everything's shit.
But it's fatalist too, because it's
deterministic. They know they don't want to change it. They don't feel they have the individual power to change it. In fact, the only man who feels he can change something is this drunken priest, Welsh Walsh. And you asked me to open the scene three, and I even wrote down here when I was reading it, Welsh processes Tom's death and projects his own fears of loneliness, which is kind of how it opens. He starts to talk about Tom's death, but then he elucidates a lot. He starts to open in ways he wasn't ready for, and saying, well, why did he do that? Well, why would a policeman do that? Do you think he was trying to find something in there?
Yeah, he has this great speech about hope and all of the things he had in this life, even if it's just watching the football on
it's
TV.
It's something instead of nothing. Why did he choose nothing? And then he starts to say, but maybe he did make the right choice. Maybe there's something better in nothing. Like, he momentarily considers in the second paragraph of that speech, and he's really talking about himself, is there something better in the nothing? Because this is not very good. There's something wrong here.
This is one of the things that's so interesting about his character, is that he's so committed to this effort to minister to these people who are obviously monsters.
Mm-hmm.
That he sacrifices himself later in the play for them, and he doesn't just leave. And he is, in doing so, in failing to leave, he's exemplifying all of the issues here, which is this inability to escape this gravity well of horror.
Mm-hmm.
But the question remains, why he doesn't leave, because he can.
I think there is a slightly mythic, possibly it's, if you want to go too grandiose, it's a Jesus-like sacrifice, but certainly it's a Christian, beautiful and idea that lies at the heart of the better parts of Christianity, or just the idea of religion when invented by a man trying to find a way in life, which is that he sacrifices himself to try and imprint the goodness of him onto the two main characters, which you could argue slightly worked. It worked in a horrible way, in that they still ended up being miserly and scornful about things that are completely material and or immaterial, or whichever you choose.
So we're ruining the end of this
play. But I do think you mentioned sacrifice already, though. So I had to build on that.
There was a broad term, but I agree with you about the Jesus allegory.
Yeah.
I've written down here, Father Welch as Jesus.
That's exactly what I wrote.
And also the pagan aspect of the shrine, but we'll get to the shrine later. So please continue. Scene three.
Okay, so the characters seem to use hate, cheap food, and meaningless competition to stay steps ahead of suicide, is what I write here. Because suicide is now on the table. They're discussing it quite openly. And the other two don't seem to be very concerned with suicide, but the more and more Welch Walsh says, why did he do it? You keep getting background reactions of the other characters saying, did you eat this? Why did you eat those crisps? And why are you getting those? They're finding reasons almost to just deliberately short-circuit the conversation, because the word suicide is causing a reaction, because everyone here in some ways contemplated it. They know they have. They must have. It's just not a situation you want to live in. You don't see it as tenable. But then they bring up this funny, to try and turn it to humor again and to use cynicism, Elias Smith and Jones is brought up. Do you remember that?
Yeah. One of them has apparently committed suicide. The good one.
The good one, as they keep mentioning, not the blonde one. The good one.
For anyone who didn't grow up with British TV, they were a famous comedy duo at the time, neither of whom committed suicide.
Yeah.
So it's this bizarre misappropriation.
This is how Valine is recognizing the suicidal situation. And when Welsh says, but he must have had something to live for. Valine says, I bet that Norwegian girl with no lips had nothing to live for. She has a good reason to kill herself. He can't see past this. It's for him. Oh, well, if he had no lips, maybe. Because that's for him about sex and being attractive. It's just completely shallow reasons to be living.
One of the hobbies that the brothers have is reading women's magazines that have these bizarre
stories and
horrific stories about Norwegian children with no lips and things like this.
I think Coleman enters then. And he takes his cynical position on retorting to what should be a very honest moment of empathy and connection with the human consciousness, which is, why did a man kill himself? Let's question this. And he starts talking about his father, and Valine, in his annoyed state that the burnt soldiers in the stove was done by Coleman. And he's so pissed off that all 32 of them, I think he said, were burnt and they're now in a big aluminium kind of mulch in this bowl. He starts shouting at him, well, you know what, I'm going to tell father that you murdered our father. And he's like, what? And then Coleman starts, I murdered him. He just outright says, yeah, okay, I killed my father. You must have known. Everyone else knows. It's just an accepted thing. And then he sits down gleefully and starts mentioning things like, well, my dad wasn't a nice person in the first place.
They argue over which thing was worse, melting the figurines
or killing their own father. And Coleman says, well, you know, at least he had it coming. He insulted my hair. And there's just some things he can't let go. And he says, like, my father, by the way, he once kicked my cat as a kid. And I can tell you one thing, now that he's dead, there'd be a lot less kicked cats.
But the insult is fantastic. I think I've written it down here. The insult that he
about his hair.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find the exact wording. I don't have it. I don't have it. What he said? What's it says? He looks like a drunk child. So his hair is
something like hair of a drunk child. And his retort was, and I just combed it, so it's not true.
Yeah, it was definitely not true. It was perfectly fine. He deserved everything that was coming to him.
Yeah.
You don't need to make jokes about a man's drunken hair, for God's sake.
And that's for him a line. And it's the use of language like he's moral. It's the use of moralistic type language of, there is a line, that there are some things you cannot say. And yet it's based on such immaterial things. It's based on nothing. But they're taking on the rubric and rhetoric of someone who's being moralistic, because a priest is in the room. They're reacting on that. But these are brothers who were just playing with language because the base of themselves are monstrous. His hair was bad and he got judged and he couldn't take it. And he impulsively murdered his father because he's incredibly vain and shallow. And that's it.
Yeah, and then we get this great face-off between the brothers.
One of two.
Because what Coleman does in response is, he says, well, I might have murdered our father, but you blackmailed me.
You
got the will and all the money.
Yeah,
and the priest is sitting here, like, hearing all of this.
The wealth of sin.
Shocked, horrified, tearing his hair out in anxiousness.
Mm-hmm. And then he's brought to a pitch of anxiety and hate for hearing these things, and to try and stop them from fighting, which he can't. He just wants to stop the aggression. He commits his first sacrifice, and he buries his hands into the molten metal in the bowl and screams at a high pitch, but deliberately holds the scream as if to take the pain and not exclaim it for 15 seconds as it's described. And then the stage direction says he screams then for 10 long seconds at a high pitched screech that causes the two brothers in startlement to stop fighting.
Which, I mean, if you imagine that, literally, I've never seen the play performed, but if you imagine that on stage, that's a very long amount of time.
10 seconds screaming, yeah. The actor has to make it a screech as well.
That is a piercing moment of horrified humanity screeching at the emptiness of this gallows humor.
Mm-hmm.
This almost almost trench humor.
I was going to say Gallows as well, but you beat me to it. Now I don't have a description for it.
It's black comedy. I was referring to George Galloway's.
No, of course. It's black humor, though. It's humor reflecting off what isn't there, which is a moral center, a sense of consciousness, nothing. It's just the brothers are back to arguing over the same petty shit again, but this time the subject is so serious and yet to them means nothing. You know?
And there is something very Irish about all of this. These two brothers, of course, are caricatures, but, you know, growing up in Ireland in the 1980s...
As you do.
I mean, many of my contemporaries in school and so on were these very almost psychopathic people who seemed to have been so deracinated of their humanity that the only pleasure that they could derive was through sadism.
Constant sadism and occasional masochism as well.
Yeah, and really, and not trivial stuff. I'm not talking about bullying. I'm talking about my brother went to school with, you gotta be very careful here, but there was an
I'll mention my cases if you want, it's fine.
No, I think this is worth mentioning, but mm-hmm. you know, we live in a society that has no protection from liability legally, so I gotta be careful. But
yeah,
there was a tragic accident, mm-hmm. air quotes here, to a young person in the vicinity of my brother, and what had happened was that his playmates had kind of laughingly sent him to his death. So I won't get any more specific than that, but this happened, and these kind of things happen, mm-hmm. happen here, and a similar thing happened when I was in secondary school, where there was, God, you'll be so careful with this stuff. There was a death that was not accidental, and that while the person who led to the death was never convicted or even arrested, was probably engaged in this kind of way, which is to say, not for any good reason, but out of the sheer pleasure and callousness of murder. And that is what this play is about. So for me, this is like I'm recognizing this. It's not only caricature, it's not only hell.
I would back you up and to say that thanks to a certain sensationalist media, which I usually dislike, but actually helped us in trying to put alarm bells up for the series of just almost silent but expected and understood crimes that just happen as if they're part of a greater Irish play behind the scenes, I would say that you could back that up with what happened in Limerick when those hysterectomies were happening almost every day. And the plenty of nurses in circulation of all kinds, this is not just six people keeping a secret, saw it and just thought nothing of it or never mentioned it. It was only an English nurse, in fact, who was the whistleblower for that case. And the series of other things in the 80s and then even late 90s, these horrific crimes, not just of hysterectomies, of local murderers, of IRA men just being able to come into a bar, shoot someone in the head, and no one, and this is, by the way, past the board on the south side, and no one being able to say anything about it. In fact, not even wanting to, because why? It's not my business. Just that level of detachment and being able to disassociate mm-hmm. so heavily from any sense of moral righteousness. And I know that it's not fair to say there's an empirical definite moral centre of things, but there is a defined moral center for human beings and not killing one another that's substantiated by all of human history, which even though you might say it's gone on the rye a few times, at most we don't tend to like killing each right. other.
All societies agree that you shouldn't rape and you shouldn't murder.
Yeah,
they might redefine those crimes quite often.
Yes,
but they do share that. But I think this is something. Maybe it's a Catholic thing mm-hmm. because in Catholicism, as is pointed out towards the end of the play by Coleman, mm-hmm. you know. It's been great. It's great being Catholic because you can do anything you want
and just say sorry.
As long as you say sorry, yeah. And there is a sense in which the lived world is not real. The real world is the life in the hereafter, and any misery in this life, as my mother used to say, "quote unquote," offer it up. Mm-hmm. Jesus' blood never failed me yet.
Your suffering is actually your currency and your exchange into the afterlife. Your complete hate and dissolution here is actually part and parcel of testing yourself for the next one. It's a kind of it's eschatological. It's that eschatological bend that has been so pre-existent and preeminent in a lot of major religions past paganism, and yet we never seem to. Whenever I mention it to people, by the by, not that I would just casually say, you know, we all want to die, but whenever you get to the crux of it, people kind of see you to that point and then don't agree with that aspect, which is that there is some aspect of particularly Irish culture and a huge amount of Catholicism that wants the world to end or is willing to even let it now in its current state, which is somewhat apocalyptic, fall to a certain kind of end. If it wasn't for the highlighting principles of a kind of new Dublin as well, okay, maybe not fair to say it's just Dublin, but certainly a new kind of Ireland that was able to put spotlights on things like this man Limerick, who 60 hysterectomies in the space of like only 4 years. If it wasn't for our sense of new, well, not moral righteousness, but our sense of being aware that there's a world without these things, that you can't, you can have medical professionalism, you can't just be horribly tearing out wounds. the ability to say that's wrong, it seems very new to Irish culture.
I think moral courage is a Protestant ethic.
Whoa.
The idea that you should question authority.
Yeah.
It goes back to reading the Bible. It goes back to deciding for yourself what you should do. And Catholicism is wholly against that. You should not think for yourself. Mm-hmm. What is a sin is defined. It's defined by the clergy and it's defined by society. You should be told what to do and you should respond to it. And if you don't respond to it, go into a laundry, go into a borstel, get away from your leave the country. You are you are dehumanized.
Mm-hmm. Quickly.
And we still live in a society that thinks in that way. We've just moved the goalposts a little bit.
In a 1984 sense, you're not just dehumanized, but then you're retrudged and turned into the very machine that then enforces those laws later on. In fact, that's the thing they never mentioned about the Magdalene houses. The women who made it out of it became trenchant Catholics. A lot of them did. They would be some of them, thankfully, were able to remember the extreme trauma and take on the kind of identity of a victim. And by the way, that's absolutely what they were. And that's something that they should, it's horrific, they have to live it, but their victimhood saved them. They were able to see themselves as, I'm the victim of something, this was not my fault. Which was the thing that the Catholic Church was very good at tricking you into believing, that it was your fault. And then there were those who actually became the very machines of that system, that actually enforced it, and would send their own children after being in a Magdalene home to a Magdalene home. Because that's what you did. And my girl needs to be fixed like I needed to be fixed. And that's a really scary thing about any large institution, especially one that plays on the spirituality and the consciousness of man like a church does, is the ability to make it, the ability to almost, how do I put it, turn into a function, or turn into a machine like function, your hate for yourself into basically an enemy, make you the enemy of your own self, basically to turn you into the machine that enforces them, converting you in a way that you never thought you could. Reminds you of 1984 a lot anyway, just by the ending of
the great ending in 1984, where he truly loves Big Brother because he's internalized the ability to look at 4 and see 5, or look at 3 and see 4, no longer desires the woman that he's fallen in love with, and both of them look like wretched old men anyway, sitting in the Victory Cafe drinking Victory gin and with their teeth falling out, and this horrifying, the true victory, and they don't kill you until you get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Is when you believe. You need to believe to die. And it's
and he is aware of his own death, and he knows he's going to die soon. He doesn't care. He's happy. He actually feels a sense of glee at the end. It's scary shit. Anyway, back on to our play.
So there is this great face off the end, where not only with the hands in the molten plastic, which does succeed, which ends the conflict between the brothers. Once again, the antagonism has been ratcheted up, and once again Father Welch has stopped the conflict at cost of ever greater sacrifice. But there is this prefiguring of what will happen later with the face off with the guns, and it's also bringing in this kind of Western American fictive tradition of a face off with a gun, which was something kind of quite alien to Irish theatre, but also kind of ludicrous in the context of Irish theatre. And later on in the play, not to spoil anything, but the gun is used. And it's something which at the time must have been really quite a shot across the bows of Irish theatre, because modern Irish theatre is all black boxes and no budgets, and traditional Irish theatre is a very static kind of set. So in a very visual, visceral way, you have something happening on stage that isn't just talking.
An active chemical explosion on stage. And it's not even done at a person. It's done at an object that then has to react and explode, which would have been interesting to see.
And that even in this scene, we have the smoking figurines belching smoke across the stage.
And a man burning his hands and using a towel to try and get his way into this extreme furnace at the gas mark 10, burning away his figurines. I like that, if we jump onto the next scene as well, they... jumping a scene forward just momentarily, he gets the figurines back, just to mention passively. Do you remember that?
Let's go to scene four. So scene four begins. So scene four is Gurley and Father Welch at the lake. So this is
So
the figurines are replaced, but not till later. So this is kind of the first scene we have dedicated to Father Welch, and it's the scene where he articulates his desperation and utter sorrow at his failure to make a meaningful contribution to the spiritual life of this community. Gurleen flirts with them some more.
She does, but she flirts with them now, and the flirtation starts to change. It takes on a new context that's imported thanks to the father now being drunk and kind of loose enough with his lips to acknowledge that this flirtation is ridiculous and she's never listened to him. And then she's forced to actually admit her feelings and somewhat say, actually, I do listen to you and I've taken some of the things you say very seriously. And
he rebukes her because they're completely unable to connect, which is another great theme of the play. Not one character connects to any other in a meaningful way. Even these two characters who have this empathy for one another, this interest in one another, cannot find a common ground.
Well, at the end of the scene, it is suggested that they've found not common ground, but they were able to understand one another for a second at least.
But even there, it's a misunderstanding
because it turns out her understanding is much different from his.
Hers is much different from his, and he realizes that there's more to her than this kind of flirtatious empty girl. But he doesn't realize what's important to her, and he kind of berates her about wasting her money on silly nonsense from catalogs. But it'll emerge that, well, she wasn't wasting it at all.
Yeah.
And, but there's also a really strange interaction at the end of this scene, which is that he is sitting at this lake, very obviously staring across the lake where the policeman has just been drowned, drinking. I mean, you don't have to be Inspector Clouseau to figure out where this is going.
Yeah, yeah. And she's yet unable to completely to see the pattern and the setup of what's about to happen.
I think more than that, though, there's a moment where she seems to almost encourage him to top himself. She says, you know, it's more than Thomas has killed himself down the years. Do you know, Father?
Yeah, she gives a history of three other guys. Walked in here. Yeah, yeah.
You know, not a bad way to go.
I think that was more just a little slip of exposition for the audience, than her kind of encouraging it. She definitely didn't want it to happen, especially by the reaction she gives later on, which is one of kind of surprise tragedy. So only actually, if anything, it's the two brothers who kind of say with a kind of chagrin and again with this lucid detachment, they say, yeah, he killed himself. That is horrible. In a kind of knowing way that maybe they expected this to happen, not necessarily for the suicide. And if anything, they're pissed off that he left the football team. But that's kind of what happens in this town. You top yourself or someone kills you.
Or you become a monster.
Or you become one of them.
And it's said later in the play, you know, that poor girlie, and you know, she could have done well for herself, gotten a decent man, but she'd probably end up in the loony bin.
Yeah, they say that. Yeah, she's going to end up in the loony bin now.
Because you're going to end up dead, crazy, or a monster. That's the only outcome in this town. But then there's the piece about Father Welch talking about, you know, the why this death didn't need to happen, and that how the living have the possibility of being happy. Well, actually, that's something that Gerline says, because Gerline, she says this doesn't depress her, this lake of death, and graveyards don't depress her because she's alive and she can feel the dead, they're done, but they're perfectly happy for her to be alive.
Yeah. In fact, it's an odd thing. She's suggesting an equilibrium. She's saying, I'm not quite judging them for still being alive, and they're not quite judging me for still being alive as well, but they are respectful of the fact that I see something worth being in the world as opposed to not being, and I respect that they chose to not be. And that's the part where you could say she doesn't mean to, but there's an encouraging aspect being given to the father, which is, if you choose the crossroads of death, there's an understanding between me and you.
Yeah, and she's equivocating life and death by suggesting that there's an attitude that the dead have towards the living.
Yeah.
I mean, the father is essentially an atheist at this point. He talks about sin, but he gets catechism wrong all the time. He nearly gives away someone's confession in one of the previous scenes. He is an appalling priest. He talks at one point about something he thinks in the Bible, which is, I can't remember, it's like, be nice to someone, they should be nice.
I think that's what it is, he says.
Some colloquialism that's totally nothing to do with the Bible. But she expresses a belief, but it's not a Christian belief. It's this weirdly pagan kind of belief.
It's one of the first... No, it's actually, if you take the start, there's a number of pagan symbolistic, or at least mild signifiers being slipped in for the audience to perceive on some level. And I definitely took it from her talking about the possibility of being haunted. And then she said, you think these places are haunted, but they're not. But at the same time, they are. They're just not walking around and haunting me, but I'm aware that the dead are here and I'm connected with them. There's this, and it's strange and completely alien to anything Catholic, which is almost tries to be scientific in what it codifies as, that's the dead, that's divination, don't look at that. And of course, again, he can't communicate on that level. He's just like, yeah, okay, is that what you see? But he does hear the message he's saying, which is, there's a crossroads here. Here's the plus minus interesting on, if you die, if you live, this is what you get. If you die, this is what you get. She gives like a PMI breakdown, and which I liked, because it was, for her, a moment of clarity. It's like she'd never spoken in this way before. But for him, it was like, oh, okay, I think I know which choice I'm going to make, which is obvious now to the audience. But yet she doesn't get it. She doesn't see that she's played a kind of an influential role in the suicide he's about to have.
And yet, the feeling I get, you know, I'd need to read it again to be sure, but the feeling I get is that on some unconscious level, she is guiding him towards it. You know, she does react very, you know, with great sorrow when the inevitable happens. But at the same time, there's this... She shows so little care about, like you said, the divide between life and death, which she doesn't see as an end or termination at all. That Yeah, there seems to be a little push.
No, I think it's I think you're reading in that only in a mild teleological way, as if to suggest in some way we share, not that we're sharing consciousness, that we, but we understand each other's consciousness more than maybe you're giving it credit for. Maybe you're giving too much credit to that as an idea. To be specific, go back to the Oleana, and I was saying that the big principle that caused politics to appear was miscommunication, as in that the principle of how the text was written is constant miscommunication, right? And part of that is the theme of someone interpreting from someone else's seemingly nice revelation a completely different message to suit their own unconscious drives. And I think his unconscious drives at this point were very conscious, which is, I'm going to kill myself. She was talking of something of this moment as a nice revelation for herself, which is, I actually am quite at peace with the dead. But she didn't mean it to be an influence. If anything, she meant it to be something quite heartening, something that was quite nice.
Yeah,
but he didn't take warmth from it.
Well, she's missing some signs, because he's talking about leaving and not coming back.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And he's going to leave. He's going to leave next day.
And I still think it's very funny that she says that everyone else says, which is, "But the under-12s football team,
they're going to need you. They're going to need you, Father." So the next scene, scene five,
which is I think it's Valine silently reading the letter, isn't it?
Oh, it's Father Welch himself reading the letter.
Yes. Well. It's him. He's positioned on the stage, I think, just a mild spotlight over the top part of his body, and everything else is a complete darkness. But isn't it meant to be him reading the letter, or is it meant to be Valine? Oh, well, no, you're right. It is just him reading it.
Yeah, because they don't find out they don't with find the letter it, that's true. For a while.
So he's reading his letter, and it's a long and very honest and at times unstructured and a bit hefty of a speech, but it contains very real aphorisms in it that he's trying to make very clear and salient that go beyond just being Christendom and being Catholic, which is, you know, you should love your brother, because that's implicit in the relationship. And in your hate for one another, I think there is love, which at this point, if the audience hasn't gotten that, they should now, because he's telling them, which is that in this hate for one another, this is actually how some Irish people show their love.
Yeah.
It's by hating each other.
Communication through literal impact. They physically show their love. And actually, in the previous scene, there's a moment where Gerline and Father Welch come to blows. Literally, she grabs his hair and pulls it.
Yeah.
And there's a sense in which the only true moments of communication are these violent moments.
Yeah.
Which is,
but they're the most intimate. Pulling your hair back, putting a knife to the neck, pulling up a gun. This is where they're at their most vehement, demonstrating their love at its peak. This is them at their best saying, "This is how I feel." Because any other time, it's just hidden behind miserly talk or talk around cynicism. It's
monstrous. They also the Christ metaphor becomes explicit, where he says, I would take that pain and pain a thousand times worse. He's talking about the pain
infinitely
of
as well.
Putting his hands in the molten plastic of the figurines. I would take that pain and pain a thousand times worse if only I could restore to ye the love you do so woefully lack.
Mm-hmm.
So he's literally sacrificing himself for them in some bizarre
sense. And he also, to play on the eschatological idea of the afterlife, the great infinite, he says infinite suffering of my soul. He promises that his soul will go into infinite suffering if he's wrong about their love.
And well, that's how they interpret it.
No, here's the thing. I think he knows that's a clause, because he knows that they're very stupid, shallow people that only follow bylaws of Christendom. In other words, they even say it themselves. You kill yourself, you go to hell. But if you kill someone else and say sorry, it's fine. So he knows they literalize. They literalize everything about the Ten Commandments and old and new Catholicism. And I think he's using that bylaw against them by promising his soul away. I think that's the greater part of his sacrifice, and which we're going to get to the end. But that last symbol of, I'm going to tear this apart, but actually I'm going to pin it back up. That's the importance of it. He's going to hang over them with that. That's my law. That's my soul being sacrificed to give you one.
It's a covenant.
Yeah.
The Old Testament
Not
sense.
Quite an arc. Yes, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Anyway, were you going to say something about this?
No, that's all I have on that scene. It's quite quick. It's just a speech, and then it brings us into scene six.
It does bring us into scene. Sorry, I'm just pretty quickly reading over what I'm looking at here. Yes, so scene six is that they've returned from, is it Tom's funeral? Tom the policeman?
No. Yes.
Yes, it is. They have. So they're wearing black again, and just like the beginning and the end is returning. It's the exact same repetition compulsion of coming back from funerals. And this time they're wearing they're still wearing black, and they're still bleak about it. And they talk about. Do they mention food this time, or is it more just that they mentioned the funeral was boring? And
they struggle again over a packet of crisps.
That's it, yes.
The food doesn't come into it until a little later.
Yeah, but that's true.
We'd lost over something that happened earlier, which is Father Welch accidentally revealed that Coleman hadn't had any sexual relations with Gurleen.
Oh, he reveals the lie, yeah.
Which is where that's where the kind of real wrath comes in, which leads to
Coleman burning all of
the destruction of the statues. Yes. Yeah. So this revelation that of his sexual inexperience. So they bicker about that again in this scene.
Mm-hmm. They do. Yeah. I'm trying to recall though how it opened.
I can't remember how it opens, but when they're fighting, it's Gurleen this time who intervenes with as you mentioned, a knife to Coleman's neck.
Yes.
Again, this brutal physical separation of their conflict.
Yeah, it was quite funny because she comes in and finds the two of them who've erupted into argument over crisps. This time Coleman openly opens, he comes in front of him and demonstrates opening the packet and says, I'm not going to pay a certain amount because I've asked you before. And I said I would pay this much. Isn't that what the whole thing was? Because previously they'd had potatoes. There was an argument and he had to pay him a certain amount of money. And he actually overpaid Valine. And Valine actually said, don't overpay me. Because there's a sense of guilt in even having too much money. And he gives him back exactly 3 pence. Now he's saying, I'm not even going to pay you because I tried to be a nice guy. I'm going to open the fucking crisps. I'm going to eat the fucking crisps. And he's eating them in front of him going, what are you doing? What are you going to do about it, you fecker? And there's a whole questioning of one another. Like, what's going to happen? As if the question is a chide to erupt the other one into some sort of event. And then they break into a fight, which was, I think it was just over the crisps because he deliberately ate them and then smashed the other crisps in his hand.
Yes,
to try and punish him.
Pee scenes or whatever.
Yeah, and the extreme miserly defense of the material he paid for that comes from Valine makes him launch it over the table and hold his brother down, who then crushes more crisps in his hand, which then makes him try and kill him. And then eventually the bursts in, I think I can't remember if she was covered in rain or if she was just generally angry, but it bursts in a blushed Gurleen, who rips them up from one another and pulls a knife out of the kitchen drawer and holds it against Coleman's neck and says, get away from one another. And that actually causes Valine, oddly enough, to say, ah, oh, no, what are you doing? Don't kill him. Like, actually, he was about to kill him. Well, but
it's only he who's allowed to kill his brother.
Yeah, exactly. Someone else, there's a kind of unreality to it, which makes him break away and say, don't do that. What are you doing? And then she explains that the Father Welch has gone and walked into the lake like Tony has done beforehand and the other three mysterious men.
And also that the necklace
that she'd been saving up in this magazine to get this necklace from
that was what she was selling Putchin for. It wasn't so she could waste it on the local boys of the area. It was so she could buy this necklace to gift him, which is a very strange thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what the necklace represents to her.
Something feminine, but she lives in an entirely feminine world, whatever is left of it in dried up Hicksville. And she takes it out. And I found it brilliant that she threw it down in a mock destruction of the symbol, throwing into oblivion of like, the love is gone, so the symbol is gone. He betrayed me. And they go, well, now don't destroy it.
Yeah, that's a good necklace.
That's a really good necklace.
She cuts it with the scissors, actually, doesn't she?
She tries to cut it in half.
Okay,
with a knife.
With the knife.
Yeah, she tries to cut it in half.
Castrating the symbol.
Yeah, exactly. Cutting it and just, again, casting it to oblivion. And then they both say, well, now don't do that. Now would you stop? And they take it off of her. She runs out in a fit and say, well, she's mad. She could have destroyed it perfectly.
We'll keep this for her. We'll give her
when she comes back. Now, it does actually turn out later on that they did try and return it to her. Which I found interesting, because that's the first of many tropisms. Tropism being the change, the turning back, the sudden soul being formed and turning in on itself and recognizing that there's something that needs to not happen anymore because this is horrible. And the first is that they try and give an object back that has extreme wealth, at least for them in their desiccated lives. They try and give it back to her because they actually prefer the idea of her having it than selling it. Now, eventually they do get it back and say, oh, we're going to sell it. But I found that the first of many changes that's about to happen in the last two scenes.
But there's also, I can hear my belly continually rumbling throughout this episode. Apologies to anyone listening to this rancid gurgle.
It's the entirety of it.
What else was there? There was another point about that scene. Gosh, I'm half asleep. I've had a long weekend. Apologies.
But excellent weekend, and we are free to talk about it.
Oh yeah, let's talk about me.
We've done it before. Amazing. Threat detection.
That's true.
We just go off on divergences. They're fun.
I don't know. I was covering a conference, helping to record a conference on the pedagogics of unlearning, and all of the talks from that conference are available on my SoundCloud. Just take a look. They're there if you want to listen to them. Jacques Rancier and Jack Halberstam and Paul Bowman and all of these.
Halberstam is interesting, at least. Right.
Are you familiar with Halberstam's work?
Yes, I am, actually, because he's the only name I recognise from there. That's already in my head. I'm indexing.
Well, Halberstam very famously wrote a blog post about trigger warnings and why they are pernicious and stifle academic discussion and mm-hmm. make it impossible to really address material, and don't work anyway, because Jack Halberstam, as well as being an academic, is also a psychoanalyst, and you know, trauma is not triggered by what we know, it's what we don't know. It's the uncanny.
Absolutely,
symbol.
It's the uncanny, it's the unheimlich, the unhomely that triggers trauma, not some word or set of suggestions, unless you're particularly sensitive, but then you're playing into someone's psychosis and destroying everyone else's freedom for it. I'm sorry if you think that, but that's exactly what I believe, and I'm happy to fight for it. But I found him very interesting because his psychoanalysis is a lot of, it led into a lot of what I understand now as homeostasis.
I'm just realizing we should have totally called our video game podcast Trigger Warning.
Oh, we should have.
That would be so much better.
Beautiful. Oh, but it's done to death now. There's enough hashtag trigger warnings out there that it's gone, though. We're coming to the end of the play.
So is scene seven, it is the final scene.
Yeah.
So this is the scene where all of the tensions and aggression, this burbling violence that has erupted constantly, but always been broken apart mm-hmm. by Father Welch, by Gurley.
No more interruptions, though.
There's nothing
no more
to keep
Flaubertian
them apart.
Interruptions. This is it at its peak.
This is it.
Pitch and peak. It's turning up to 11. As
finally, the orgasm is possible. This is like at the end of series one of what's that psychotherapy drama series?
Oh, In Treatment.
In
it's
Treatment.
Like, go bang her. But I can't bang her because it was part of the dynamic in the
finally,
power relationship.
Paul is going to transgress.
Yeah.
The transgression here could be fratricide.
Yes. Murder of brothers, just explain.
So the scene opens. The brothers have returned home after yet another wake. I think the third in the play.
Yeah.
Father Welch's.
And this time they have something to share on and agree on, which causes a momentary synthesis, which is that the sausage rolls and vol-au-vents were amazing. And the Catholic Church went all out because it was a priest. Yeah. And they loved that they could take all of the food.
They stole so much
the
food.
And brought it home. And there's a Valine has, not because he's a good person, but because his misery is so universal. It applies to all people, where he feels bad for other people not having that material thing. So he says, should we have taken that much? Because even he feels, because for him it's just about constant collection and keeping it where it is, because that's the thing about miserliness, it's another type of psychosis really. But with I like that Coleman again justifies the other half of this character, really, because they're two halves, and he says, no, it's fine, you know, it's vol-au-vents, no one's going to eat them, and sure would have gone to waste. And they take them all home and they start eating, and
they have a lovely picnic.
Yeah, they do. And then
they share for the first time,
and because he shares the vol-au-vents, it initiates Valine to do one thing we never expected him to do, but actually if you know plays you would expect him to do it. He shares Putching. Which up to this point he's been just ravenously angry, almost to the point of wanting to kill his brother each time he's thought to himself, have you been taking my Putching and filling it with water? Because I think you have.
And I think at this point, I think the metaphor, the Christ metaphor, it's clearly comedic, because they're literally having a Eucharist.
Yes.
This is
breaking of the bread.
The breaking of the bread.
Transubstantiation.
In memory, the Putching transformed into the blood of Father Welch.
Yeah.
So it's a little heavy, which he has his cake and eats it. It's exactly like Tarantino. You can have trashy violence and sex, but there's such irony, such knowingness, and such an understanding of the material, an understanding of the symbology, that he completely
and
pulls it
total
off.
Total confidence to deliver and not hold back, and to make it almost crassly obvious. And that, I like that. That's why Tarantino, as you mentioned, is so good. It's the confidence to deliver on it and say, that's my style.
Yeah.
Pastiche or no, that's pulp.
And this is so 90s. This level of irony is so 90s. I think people are more cynical now, and also less cynical in a way. And you couldn't. I think this would have an audience now would react to it either with disdain at your sacrilegiousness, or with kind of knowing
total
smugness.
Apathy for what they think has been done to death in their mind.
But in the 90s, there was this moment of the kind of freeing of irony, where the final crux of belief in the state and the hegemony of the goodness of the state and the goodness of the American Empire was snapped and cracked, and you had this beautiful freedom of irony.
People like Armando Nucci, Sam Bainbridge, and
Chris Morris, of course, did
not arise from just funny observations in their gyms and suburban lives. This is arose in an age where irony, as you said, has been set free, and where cynicism is a new type of thinking. Cynicism was a whole another academic realm you could have a discipline in. Cynicism was this greater, funnier form of skepticism without just the science that had added poetry to it. Now cynicism, I know you like David Mitchell, but it's been turned to something very dark. I find that cynicism now is something that is almost no poignancy. It's lost with the meaning of black comedy. It's just something that's
said. It's upholding the existing power structures rather than attacking it.
I think of like the David Milch's soapbox is a perfect example of, oh, here's a man who's going to be a little bit cynical on a thing I already know the undercurrent essentialist aspects of.
In a Zizekian sense, it's capitalist realism. Mm. It's not the cynicism of things are terrible. We know they're terrible. Maybe we can't do anything about it, but we can. God damn it, we can admit they're terrible in a way that's subversive. Mm-hmm. It's the cynicism of, everybody knows this is how things are,
yeah,
and we'll just admit to it. And,
isn't that so funny? And
then horrible.
People use it more just to grab adjectives and go, that adjective is funny. That is what that thing is that I can label, because it's more about labeling and consumption of language than it is about anything else.
And it's about being part of this community of knowing and this kind of superior. And I think the line for me in comedy is between you get a brass eye, and then a couple of years later you get monkey dust. And monkey dust is cynical. Brass eye isn't cynical. It's it's romantic in its desire to critique society, like all satire. Is and monkey dust is pure bleakness.
Well, I really like monkey dust, but I completely agree with what you're saying when it comes to the type of cynicism and where it goes. If you take the day-to-day in Brass Eye, it's Kenneth Russell and it's operatic beautrousness. It's trying to raise the pitch. It's being creative and giving us a new access point for seeing things that are actually horrific about sensationalist media and what media can do. And then you take media now in the Charlie Brooker style, which is, let's just have swipes and vertical slice clips thrown together with my hilarious take on the whole thing. Now, I like a little bit of Charlie Brooker, but that's just the thing. I like him. I don't think he's the new cynical philosopher that people make him out to be, because cynicism now is just another tool of being famous.
It's just another tool of maintaining the status quo.
Which I think famousness or being famed is part of that anyway, in that sense.
And that's what the 2000s were. I mean, people critique hip. Hipsterism, but the worst thing about hipsterism is the commodification of irony. Mm-hmm. Irony is no longer a tool to indicate you are part of the community of subversives. Irony is now a brand, like Nike, and you wear it in exactly the same way to reference your membership of a certain socioeconomic group.
It's what I used to call the social CV. It's just another work experience skill tick that you have there, saying, I've done the cynical thing, I've seen that show. Have you watched Monkey Dust? Yeah, I've watched Monkey Dust. I'm in on that.
Yeah.
And so then, I can add myself into the cynicism of this conversation.
And then you get the emergence of this new sincerity movement, which is a reaction to it in the other way, which is to say it's all great. Actually, everything's fantastic, which is the ultimate defeat of the counterculture.
Like Henri de Saint-Simon positivism nonsense, which again gets you nowhere. The middle ground is struck usually by some sort of heroic philosopher. That's how I see it. Maybe I'm just too pedagogical or I'm searching for a father figure, but that's how I tend to see great movements in history, is enough people, great thinkers, come together and help with new turns of language and study to change it. I mean, that's how the 60s worked with liberal movements. But I can't imagine
my 68.
The My 68, yes, of course.
But on the battlements.
Daniel Cohn Bennett, I should say, and in his Nanterre School Revolution and the Sorbonne and everything that came from that. But we don't have equivalents of that. And insofar as now, when you have movements like that, they're quickly turned into televisual rolling news pieces. So they're happening all the time, yet they're not happening.
The revolution will be tweeted.
It's just more lensing. It's just this time it's a detached affair. Through the television screen or through the PC screen. Here's your chunk for the day. I want my non-terror school revolution. I'll watch this hilarious clip of it for 10 minutes. But I'm bored.
That's why I think...
I gotta go wank.
That's why I think...
10 more windows open.
That's why I think Baudrillard is such an important philosopher for this period in history, because his idea, this simulacrum and simulacrum idea that the image has become everything, and it's impossible for us to interface with reality, and we no longer acknowledge the realness of reality, we're existing in ever more distanced virtualities. I think that's really true.
It's something that Rollo May picked up on and didn't give enough credit to Baudrillard for the influence, but it was beautifully worked through when he mentions Otto Rank and Redenard and these other really formative psychotherapists that people didn't know when he wrote his book Love and Will in 1969. And he taps into this, look, there may be a natural split between when you have sex in an organic level, which is that when it happens out organically compared to the intellectual being you're developing as, those are two separate things. And we cause a detachment and we cause a fricard that we don't quite resolve, which leads into a series of issues where we repress certain aspects and cause freedoms of others. But then he mentions something beautiful, which he says, you take the Victorian repression that once existed that caused us to have these libidinal explosions, these things the unconscious had to push out, and now you have the opposite type of anxiety, which is the anxiety of too much freedom. You're too free, and yet somehow you're not free. Do you see what I'm saying? There's the opposite end of the spectrum, where the level of freedom is almost impinged upon you. It's your right to go have sex, but make it casual. Don't make it love.
I've always been very suspicious of that discourse, though, because it's very much on the lines of... not 1984, but what's the other book that is the
Brave New World?
Brave New World, exactly. Mm-hmm. This idea of the tyranny of liberty, and I think
it's a
thin line, though.
It's a prescribed liberty he's talking about.
That's exactly the same as in Brave New World. Huxley talks about this. His vision is a world where you're forced into casual sex, you're discouraged from monogamy,
long term commitment. Don't have eros, just have libido.
Everyone is medicated, and you know it's a great metaphor for the modern world. It's not exactly inaccurate, but at the same time, it's as a critique of liberalism, I think it misses the mark, because the issue with liberalism is not the enforcement of a way of life, it's the detoothing of agitation and of dissidence. But that's, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he certainly predicted the world better than Orwell did.
Yeah.
In a pragmatic sense.
Well, only practically. I still think that Orwell captured what happens to the human mind and the types of slavery we can, what slavery turns us into, more that's importantly.
A much better book as well.
Yeah, people always compare the two. They're not comparable. One's a lot better.
What is a great work of 20th century fiction, and the other is a good sci-fi story.
Yeah, which is a bit funny. Now, to go back into the play, though, we're at the end.
Take us through scene 7.
So, as we discussed, they have taken the Volivans, and now the Putchings mean shared because Coleman has shared his Volivans. And then they start discussing the sausage rolls and Volivans in a little bit of detail. Both agreeing that sausage rolls are good, but Volivans, Coleman likes more than I've just forgotten his name again. Valine does. So, Valine starts to unravel a little bit. So, the involution takes place here, the reverse of revolution, going backwards into themselves, saying, well, it was terrible that the priest died. And they go, yeah. And they start agreeing that he was a good man. And in agreeing that he's a good man, they trigger something, which is, let's try and resolve some of the things he wanted us to do. Let's just do it for him. And this is where the imprint starts to take a little bit of an effect. Not for the good, necessarily. So they start admitting the things they've done wrong to one another. Coleman starts with, I did this wrong. And I can't remember. I think it was a pretty small thing. And then Levine says, well, I'm sorry for, hitting you on the head there. And I'm sorry for doing that. And then Coleman says, I'm sorry for saying that you're detached and you're horrible and miserly. I'm sorry for that. And then Valine comes back saying, I'm sorry a little bit earlier, when your hair was grabbed and the knife stuck, I'm sorry about that. And then it gets into, well, when you've been drinking all that putty and you think I've been filling up with water, and I have for 10 years. And then Valine goes, that's actually really aggravating, and I want to, I'm taking a step back. And this is beautiful because they keep using the language of disassociation, which is active moral disassociation, which is to try and not let your feelings run away with you. And they're using this, saying, I'm taking a step back, I'm not going to hit you, but that really pisses me off, you fecker. To which Coleman replies, I'm sorry I did that then. And he goes, but are you actually sorry? And he goes, I am sorry. And Valine goes, okay, well, if you're sorry, I have one that might top that, though.
So very quickly, it's become a game.
Escalate, yeah.
And this reminded me of the book Games People Play and Transactional Analysis, the form of psychotherapy.
I'm thinking of Woody Lang,
Well, the idea in Transactional Analysis is that our interactions with people are stereotyped, in that we fall into these symbolic interactions where we perform a role in a known loop of behavior that becomes conditioned,
and it's often about power.
It's often about power, and here we've got this kindness that masquerading as kindness, what very quickly becomes
another power game to play off one another, and the kindness is being used to attack one another. Who's going to tell the greatest story? And then the askance that comes with the other person's reaction means my story's going to hit harder. I used to describe it as emotional knives, which is like you're using the material someone's given you to stab back at them. And in this case, it erupts pretty badly when Valine says, well, that girl that you loved that was mentioned earlier in the story, who had a pen fall down her throat. So we know she's a fucking idiot.
She was sucking on the nib.
The wrong end of a pen. And someone nudged the pen down her throat. And then earlier on, the priest said, so did she die? He goes, no, she married the fecker, pulled the fucking thing out of her.
Sure, anyone could have done
that. And he goes, I could have done that. Anyone could pull a pen out of her. It's not just a doctor. Anyway, Valine reveals, I was the one who nudged the pen down her throat because I was jealous. And then Coleman goes, you fecker. I so hate that you did that.
That was my dream, my only chance of love.
And he goes, you even sorry about that? Because I was going to escape with her. I would be here with her now instead of with you. So are you actually sorry? And Valine goes, oh, I'm totally sorry.
I'm so sorry.
Well, I've got one that's going to top that. And then Valine goes, no, you don't. And then he says, well, remember the dog we mentioned earlier in the story? Remember the dog that had his ears cut off and no one believed that the old lassie had his ears cut off and who would do it? It wasn't Martin, it was me. And Valine immediately knows what's going to be said and says, I don't believe it. You're gonna have to prove it. No, not buying it, not taking it. So Coleman goes into his room and goes, oh yeah, and it's described in set direction as he slowly goes into his room, and then Valine starts to nervously laugh, realizing there's a possibility of honesty here. So it's not true, no. And then out comes Coleman, who with a brown paper bag, a little bit wet. So it's continually wet for some reason, which is beautiful because it's not realistic, but it's part of the joy of the scene. And he unwraps it. It's described slowly as if he's enjoying it. He's pleased with the delivery. And then he takes both dog ears and puts them on Valine's head, each one, and kind of saying, there you go.
He becomes literally dog-eared.
Again, yes, with brilliant. The literalism. Yes, literalism all the time. I literally dog-eared him, which is, there's your dog ears. And then they fall off his head as he kind of tries to throw them away and looks at them and realizes those were his dog. And he said, I love that dog. You killed my dad. You killed my dog. Is there anything you did? And Coleman goes like, I really enjoyed it. It's like, I took such pleasure in it. And that's when they finally erupt back into complete anger. And again, they both know each other so well instinctually. They see the triggers just by the way they move their legs and how they stand up, that one is going to attack the other. They can see it coming. So Coleman gets his gun. And then Valine gets his knife, and Valine is coming towards him. I love the moment where the quote is, Coleman says, now what are you doing there? And the response from Valine is, the quote is, I'm going to kill you. It's just outright, I'm going to murder you because I can't stand you. And he puts the gun to him and says, I'm going to shoot you first, and you're going to be a dead man. You'll be dead. And Valine says, I don't mind. I'll take it. And then he points it at the stove. And he goes, now would you point it away from the stove?
Yeah, listen, not the stove. Shoot me.
Yeah, shoot me.
Not my stove.
Not his stove. To which
a kind of a monster.
He does put his knife away and submits, but Coleman has to go the next level and still shoots the stove twice, blowing it up and destroying it completely. And Valine, in his anguish, says, I can't repair it. Like, that's the... So he takes the knife back out of the drawer and reinitiates the murder. And he says, and now I know you have no bullets. To which Coleman pulls out potentially two bullets, which the audience can either believe or not believe there is actually bullets he has in his hands, because he holds the fists out but doesn't display bullets. And doesn't fake reload the gun. Puts the shotgun back in place and is about to shoot him. And that's when... what is it that actually unravels them at that point? There's something... This is the point where they could kill each other, but they decide not to. They both accept that they're about to do it. It's wonderful because they both say it out loud. And in that acceptance, they stop.
They agree with each other that Father Welch was a fool to gamble his soul based on that.
That's it. Stupid gamble. I wouldn't put £5 on us, he says. Yeah.
So and fool he might have been, but he's craftily managed to prevent them murdering each other once again.
Because they put their weapons down, and there was a point where Coleman says, I'm going to go for a pint. And he puts his jacket on and leaves. And then Valine looks at the gun and it was loaded. And he goes, that bastard would have killed me. Now I'm not going to buy him a pint. And he goes towards where he'd pinned the letter from the priest with the necklace that was gotten by Gurleen.
So this is the shrine that I mentioned earlier.
Exactly, the pagan shrine.
Bizarre setup that they have with the...
Which is on the crucifix is pinned the letter. More saying this is his personality attached to that faith. Not my faith, it's his. Pinning his letter onto the crucifix. But also by covering the crucifix and allowing this new shrine to appear above it, which is a letter with a necklace, showing the potential bond and what could have been the love between these two people that they've passed through and met in their lives. And it's a lovely moment because it also it symbolically represents the great hold that he has over them now by imprinting them with his soul, his sacrifice, to remind them not to kill each other. But he pulls down. Evelyn says, nah, screw this, he's a fucking idiot, I'm going to rip this apart. He pulls it down and he sets it on fire, but then stops. And he kind of does the same thing he did earlier, which is he lovingly pulls it out so it's perfectly flat. They make sure to write that in the details. He flattens it out, pins it back up with the crucifix, puts the necklace back up. And as he leaves the room, he quickly looks back and that's the end of the play. And apparently the spotlight is meant to focus in on that shrine and then it ends there. So yeah, unless you have anything contradictory to that.
No, and I think that last moment, though, it's indicative that actually, they're far more Christian than Father Welch ever was. He has a belief in the power, the redemptive power of his act and of his faith. Mm-hmm. But they do all of the things that you do. They go to mass, they have a crucifix on the wall, they go to confession. And that's what Christianity really is. Mm-hmm. In this play, as in life. It's the ritual, mm-hmm. and it's the community. And it might be poisonous, and it might be abusive, and it might be horrific. But that is what it is. And the rest of it is just some paper that's designed to get you to do the ritual.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's
it's actually something.
I'm not saying McDonough's saying that.
But that's actually a thing that Damon Lindelof, when writing Lost, was actually trying to say in Lost as well, which is, and I know you don't like this, but that is some of the smarter parts of it. He was saying what makes the rule, or the suggestive power of the rule of in the show, by the way, at the end when they're saying you can't kill this man because he owns the island, And then it turns out you can kill him. So was it that the rule was a real power, or was it the belief in the rule, or the belief in the religious proselytizing of it made it true? That's the thing they play with all the time. Now, you'll admit that the end of Lost was terrible, and I'll go with you on that. But other parts of it were testing the idea of faith. Is faith something you enforce on yourself? It is a ritual that you give meaning to, and by actually doing it, like with history, you're making it real. Or is it just something that is divine force? Is it something that can, that is a power that goes beyond you, that's written over in the symbols? It's a beautiful question that still exists today in the questioning of, you know, how, where power is derived from and the symbols we share unconsciously. So I did like that, and I think it's a brilliant ending, actually. I wasn't expecting it to be that good. I thought the ending would just be on a dry run of, oh, well, his redemption was worth it. They didn't kill each other and that was it. I liked that they ended on the shrine.
Yeah,
I think it's a really lovely touch. It's the icing on the cake. It's the thing that made the denouement really interesting for me. Did you take the ending with much pleasure?
It's a curious ending. I think the smashing of the saints is maybe means something too. That he doesn't just shoot the stove.
Sorry,
he also smashes the new saints, which he's have been bought to replace.
All 42 of them.
Including the darky saint.
The darky saints, which he put on both sides of the white ones.
so there's a bizarre attack in, I suppose, the symbols of propriety, even though that these are the only things that are meaningful in this world, which is, I suppose, why they're attacked. That these you accrue these symbols and they show that you're a good citizen or that you're a wealthy person, and so of course they're the things that are envied.
That's very interesting. You just made me realize something. Mild epiphany. Those symbols were just shallow representations that Valine used to try and make himself feel in some way savable, you know, redeemable in the terrible things he was doing. They were just pointless symbols. One of richness, which is the stove, and the other one of the saints that he kept collecting to promise himself an afterlife. But in the ending, when all those things were destroyed, the stove and the symbols, the real Christian merit came through in his acting out, appeasing his brother. By both appeasing one another, finally, for the horrible acts they'd done, when he said, I can get into the stove anyway. He actually says, "Remember, I can get another one. It's fine." By letting go.
Well, he does, but then it's revealed that he actually can't get one because he's been stealing the insurance money.
Exactly, and that drives him crazy. But in those letting goes, at the end, like that, just let's get a pint. That is actually them acting out and processing the real merits of the better parts of religion, which is to let go, which is to forgive, and to try and build from that. Now we don't know if they'll probably kill each other one day again, but in that moment, all the representative nonsense is gone. And all that's left is the true symbols, which is the ones on the wall, and the very symbol of acting out and letting go. Because they both let go of their hate. And I didn't realize that before, but that's quite obvious now, especially the way he destroyed those symbols.
Well, something else has just occurred to me, which is actually that in a way that there's a pernicious myth at the heart of this play, which is, I think it was Walter Wick's idea of the myth of redemptive violence, which is that this violence done by Father Welch to himself, this sacrifice, sort of Christian idea, is going to save them. Mm-hmm. And it's a dangerous idea because, you know, it's the idea that drives men to glory in battle or to, you know, to policemen
the blood
to shoot
sacrifice
the running
and the blood oaths and absolutely.
And
which is a big part of our revolutionary history as well as the history of like what's going on with Arab Springs and things there as well.
Absolutely, with the Patriots sacrificing themselves in 1916 to gain a dubious sort of freedom.
Yeah. It goes to show you a great place there. It's never just one story. It's all stories.
So dense. So dense.
Or is it us that's making it dense?
So that's the scene by scene. We got some juicy crit of the thematic nature of the play.
Do I have the crit?
No, page? I saved that for me.
You bastard. I saved it for me. I am the controller of the information.
This is my stove. Shoot it, I dare you. Tear these sheets out of my hand.
Eat the stove in front of me. It's part of another
so
play.
So hopefully maybe we can provoke a discussion because I know you have your own handwritten notes.
I do.
There.
Most of them I was using to reread the scenes and my observations of them. The one thing I loved is the Irish phraseology that he adapted.
So the language. Yeah. This exaggerated. I've written Irish, you know, with the O.
Irish, yeah, yeah.
He reverses verb and subject, you know, as the Irish language does, but to an extent that is silly.
Yeah, to explain that better, it just means the positioning of the verb and the subject is out of order. Almost going back to weird kinds of Latin. The verb first, or sometimes the verb not first, verb last, and then the subject first. And this kind of idea of the subject owning the verb.
And I'm sure someone's written a great thesis about how that represents the action, the play, and they're not subject to, but subject of
exactly,
some shit like that. But,
but I like one phrase I just want to point out. I love the one describing him as a miser, specifically when Valina is being shouted at by Coleman. Coleman says, you know, I'd imagine he's off somewhere tearing the teeth out of goats, which is one lovely description of many for what this man will do for money. And it plays into the agricultural background of Ireland as well, tearing a tooth out of a goat, because teeth actually used to have value, because they used to think they were ivory. There used to be mistakes around those things. So he's playing on a beautiful misconception of the Irish people when using that line.
There's another great image, which is before... is it Feline? Does it Coleman?
I should also mention that there was practical uses of goat's teeth. But anyway, go on, sorry.
But before Coleman revealed that he... Was it... Who ruined the relationship? It was Coleman was in love, was it? And Feline pushed the pencil. Or was it the
Feline was the one who pushed the pencil. He nudged the pencil into her, and Coleman was in love. And he's an impulsive... He's the crazy one.
So that was a revelation in reaction to another revelation, which is that they both denied each other sexually. So Coleman denied Feline by not telling him that a girl who he liked... I think we might have them backwards. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
No. It was Feline who nudged the pen, definitely.
So Coleman denied Feline by... A girl who liked him asked him out, and he didn't pass on the message.
But he
says, no, that's fine. It's no big deal. She was a thin-lipped ghost with the hairstyle of a red ape.
Yeah.
So which is amazing. I love that.
It's fantastic. There was some opening moments as well. Remember, I can't. The script in the opening was
thin-lipped
fantastic.
Ghost. It's one. So the language is so great. I mean, from the opening lines, there's an exchange between Father Welch and Coleman at the start, where he says, Father Welch says, "Like an alcoholic, you paint me as half the time."
I remember this, and he goes, "That's not difficult though. A bent child."
Yeah, a bent child with no paint could paint you as an alcoholic. Which is wonderful, and that's again is this reversing of verb and subject. And this the another great aspect of the language is the neologisms, which you mentioned before we came on air. This een that they apply to everything. So this bitteen, slappeen, listeen, chaineen, girleen, and valeen or valeen. All these eens. It's this weird kind of parody of the tweeness.
The tweeness of Irish language, the lilt and the stretching of E's and Y's, and this thing about vowels in Irish people, and wee's. So that I thought that was a wonderful observation by McDonough, because everything has to have an een on it. But they focus a lot on bitteen, which is very common. It became so common that it became a product in Ireland. I think it was once a type of biscuit, a bitteen.
Really?
And it became another neologism used by people to describe biscuits and things, like have a bitteen, which derives from us saying, can I have a bit of something? Can I have a bit more? I'm a bit teen on something. Which is this idea of a person verging on too much of a displeasure. Classically Irish. Always being displeased, but I'm a bit too displeased.
It's, and that's the jouissance.
Yes, sure, why not?
But yeah, I suppose that's an interesting thing, because the een... And een is sort of it's something that only comes out of a culture of poverty. Mm-hmm. Oh, give me the tiniest bit een. This I won't take it from you, but I'll just share a little bit of it so as not to starve.
Yeah,
and I suppose that's what girleen is. She's a little bit of glamour or
feminine fluff,
and she isn't much of a character. Again, we've got a writer who, well, in this play at least, although in The Beauty Queen of Lannan we've two terrific female characters, but girleen is a slip of a girl in and out. I think
slip.
Slip of a girl.
Slip, is that right? It's a bit filthy there.
Is it?
I think you're playing on.
No. Slip is just an item of clothing. So we get a lot of language games. Last week we talked about Mammoth, it's famous for its language games, but McDonagh does this too, questioning of the meaning of terms and of the meaning of language.
This is why these plays are so famous, though, because this is what great plays do. It's unfolding words and using more excellent synonymic terms or synonyms to try and allow projection and audience participation to take place, which is that the words can mean multiple things.
They can mean
loads. But a lot of people can do that kind of faux, you know, post fucking literary course. Here's my attempt to make multiple ambiguous terms, and it's completely non-engaging. This is completely engaging. It's beautiful because people do talk like this, and in real life people do use terms. I'm doing it right now with Gareth. We're using terms that are completely preloaded with other conceptions that we don't mean to be there but are there, and that's the beauty of researching language at its natural pace. And they do, and he does it, I actually think he does it much more organically than Mammoth does. In fact, Mammoth's too deliberate. I love other Mammoth plays, but Oleana's too deliberate in where it leaves it ambiguous. There's like a deliberate dot dot dot. Did he mean that? I don't know, maybe he didn't.
Yeah.
So, at least with Act One of Oleana, that was very deliberate. He used words that would, you know, make a pimp blush, because when he's saying things like shh and I'll take care of you, like, that's, it's too deliberate. Now, I know, I still stick by my argument from last week though, which was that I still think there could be another conception for that, but either way, it's too much. You take this, though, it's wonderful, because you could go through the whole play and never give a shit about the language and just like the comedy, because it's really funny. That's something I don't know if we put across enough for these people. It's really, really funny. It's a funny play just to read through and watch, because it's great comedy to it. But if you're going to read into it, there's language there to play around with. And this is a person who knew his Irish people. He knew them very well, probably better than most.
He did, and I think there's a level to in which he inhabits the dialogue so much that he's able to parody it in a way that's not a simplistic parody of exaggerating stereotypes, but is a creation of these new terms and new ways of speaking which adhere to the kind of the hidden grammar. Mm-hmm. That exists in this kind of rural west of Ireland.
What's not
language.
Being said. But it is, that's true. He's doing it really well. He's underlining what you can't see, and it's there.
So to sexuality, mm-hmm. the virginity that's present here is shocking.
Yeah.
and in a sense, you can understand, I think, the violence of the play can
would
be understood.
Would put hairs on a virgin person's not having hair.
Oh, dear. But I think you can kind of understand all these penetrations and threatened penetrations as this pent-up sexuality.
Well, you have the knife, you have the gun to the chest, which is then pointed lower before it's pointed at the stove. It says goes low and then goes at the stove. You have, I'm trying to think, where's all the phallic, like, pushing forward of imagery? You have the priest where he thrusts his hands, I think, into it, or plunges. There's that sense of plunge and going there into. So what is actually sacrificially horrible is in another way his way of acting out in the way that a man possibly would, if we're going to go in the Freudian route. And I'm trying to think, there's lots of playing around with the thrust.
But even if we don't get into the kind of literal mapping,
the grabbing of people, the intimate attacking of one another, the readiness to be touching someone.
And yet the perversion of touch into violence and destruction. It's desperately sad and desperately true. In the history of Ireland, it's not explicit in this play, but what would happen is the eldest son would inherit and the next son would become a priest or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then eventually you get this final son or son six or of 24 who ends up with nothing. Living in a second house on the farm.
It comes from
poverty.
Bad plantation law, where each time the land would get divided up more and more until you essentially have nothing. It's such a big part of why an excellent play, The Field, has its backdrop and makes commentary on. Anyway, we'll go into The Field another time.
And so you combine that with the cloistration of sexuality that happened under Catholic Ireland, and you get this two huge forces to compel people to be. And of course sex is incredibly sinful as well, just deprived of any normative healthy sexual outlet. Mm-hmm. And this perversion and twisting of sex, not in a cool sexy sleazy way,
no, it's
but
just
in a really horribly abusive way,
back to the word miresome, it is to this miresome weaponized destructive way, where the lack of sex and the force being so suppressed and the very ignominy of it, this not touching of it, has corpulently fattened up into turning these men's energy towards something more negative, which is destruction of everything, anyone's story that's positive. Hence the start, he's very funny and cynical, but he's deliberately not letting a priest have his moment, and the priest is trying to have a moment with him, but he'll never let him have it. Everything is to be destroyed and scoffed and hated.
And it's very like the relationship of the two brothers, described by Gerlin as they'd have no use for condoms except to use them on a blind hen.
Yeah, I liked that.
These brothers, they have a very adolescent relationship. It's like the antagonistic relationship of pre-sexual adolescent boys. Mm-hmm. Pre-sexual not in the sense of pre-pubertal.
Because they haven't evolved.
They haven't evolved at all. Yeah. They've been trapped into this perpetual horror. The worst aspects of adolescence, the spraying deodorant in your brother's mouth when he's asleep, the armpits and the physicality of everything.
Oh, so it's common to me. It never happened to me.
Yeah, you should have had
a brother. No, I have a brother now, and he's much younger, so, you know, torturing is easy.
Jesus. Both brothers having had these opportunities for affection, but, you know, the pencil getting caught, there's another phallus. Pencil getting caught stuck in the back of her gob.
The wrong thing to be stuck in her mouth.
And drawn like a sword from a stone by the doctor who she falls for.
Yeah.
Depriving her for the phallus, so she becomes in love with him, because of course that's presumably they've never had sex either.
Yeah, that's I'm definitely went to that level, depriving the woman of the phallus, making her attracted to him. That's a horrible psychology. I just loved it. For some reason, when you said that, I imagined her going, "Ooh, King Arthur," and he pulls the pen.
The bastarding doctor who wrenched the pencil out of her, as he described.
Ooh, it's like King Arthur.
And there's the only sexuality is, it's just so gross. Like Gerlin jokes about tinkering with the idea of prostitution as well.
And that moment. moment, actually, there's a double face palm from the priest, from Father Welsh, who actually just butts his head and says, like, oh, Christ.
Who, of course, as the unobtainable object, is the only person desired by Gurleen.
Yeah, because he's completely untouched because of the cloth. He cannot be gotten to. And in fact, he maybe deliberately decides to not see or veil away the clear suggestions by Gurleen later on that she would like to have a relationship with him, and only allows a hug and a fond goodbye and thanks her for that last moment of transmutation.
What hope could they have had? She's a schoolgirl. He is presumably another 40-year-old man.
Oh, Jesus, didn't stop half the fucking priest guys. What do you mean, what hope could they have
had? What hope could they have had of something that wouldn't be the last scene of Lolita, that would have a hope, that would be good?
The thing is, Lolita is what happens in the nicer American variation where real jurisdiction happens. In Ireland, they got away with it for a long time. Yeah. A lot could have happened. But I understand what you're getting at, because he's not a dishonest, horrible man. He wouldn't want to be in something
like that.
There
could be nothing good in that.
I'm with you.
But while it's talking about all of this horrible cloistration of sex, it's also, the whole play is catharsis. It's this explosive catharsis of violence, of blue language, of sexual imagery.
And very little in Agnorosis as well, if you see what I'm saying. Agnorosis, discovery, the other force in Greek plays that's at play here, which is the Agnorosis of discovery and the right. Catharsis of relief. There is little discovery.
There's no
only
discovery.
At the end. In fact, that's the whole point. That's the greatest thing about postmodern and 90s plays and films. It's that they can't discover past their patterns. They can't see behind their own misguided principles. They're blinkered in every way that
there's
you can think
there's
of.
There's no lesson.
Only sacrifice in this case could bring about some level of possible transgression, or in this case I call it tropism. But I like that it's really ambiguous. It's not really, they'll probably kill each other later on. We don't really know if blood sacrifice can change.
One will kill the other.
Yeah.
And then man will be founded by the survivor and then
no, he will become Israel after fighting himself across the river.
So there is that great sense, and it must have been very palpable at the time that here is a new theatre that is irreverent in a very trivial sense, mm-hmm. but also rooted in, despite McDonagh's protestations, rooted in Irish theatrical history and writing and commenting on it.
And it's a big influence, I know, and he doesn't credit it much. Well, maybe he doesn't credit it too much at all, but he credits this kind of theatre. But David Milchin writing a show, which I really want you to see, which is Deadwood, which to me is still, and anyone who's enjoyed, by the way, theatre people would love Deadwood, is one of the all-time best dramas I've ever seen. And it's my favourite. It's absolutely beautiful in how it's written. And that show is all about the discovery of ritual, which is, it doesn't begin in some place spiritual. It begins at a place of practicality and co-option. People coming together and having to establish something. And just to make this reference worthwhile, there's a moment in Deadwood when they first form a town meeting. And in that meeting, they don't know how to appoint positions of mayor. They just have to do it because they're trying to get annexation. And Al Swearengen, who's the saloon owner, who's the real robber baron, trying to rob them all slowly, but in a weird way likes the people he's robbing by getting the prostitutes and drinks, selling it out to these prospectors. He wants to keep the town under his wraps, but at the same time knows he has to work with others. He brings in all these people and says, you're the fire officer, you're the mayor. He wants to appoint themselves as what? And peaches are had with cinnamon, just canned peaches and cinnamon. The next time they have that meeting, all of a sudden canned peaches and cinnamon are on the table, and they say, who put these here? And everybody goes, and Al Swearengen goes, I think I asked them to be put out, but I don't remember it. The point is, the first time they were there at a process of making some change in the town, it became part of a ritual to have peaches. It's the establishment of ritual. This would eventually become gavels. This would eventually become courtrooms, this small act in this horrible town in Dakota in the 1850s. And that's, I love that examination of human beings. It's not quite nihilist, and yet it is. It's saying, look, there is no greater purpose. There's no divine being or a spirit to it. But isn't there something incredible in the human being's ability to make this kind of ritual and to give it meaning? And that's, I don't think it's as strong here, but that's what McDonagh does in definitely with the, you know, the Skull of Connemara and other stories like that. It's looking into where rituals formed, as well as the other stories that are in play.
The invention of tradition.
You should really watch Deadwood, by the way. It's an incredible show. Anyway.
Well, the invention of tradition is I think it's Thomas Hobsbawm's book.
Yeah.
There's two Hobsbawms anyway, and it's this idea that the traditions that we think of as ancient and perennial are actually often new. For example, the Queen being let into Parliament with the door being closed and banged and so on, mm-hmm. That these things are created and constructed. And in a way, what these brothers have left are the empty symbols of traditions that are no longer extant. Mm-hmm. And all that is left is, you know, and we see this actually as well in McDonagh's brother, in his film Calvary. Mm. There's this very palpable sense that we have a priest again who is deprived of any moral authority and ultimately sacrificed as well, but all of this symbology of Christianity is laden throughout the place, but is kind of lost. You have these kind of broken symbols floating around potentially dangerous.
Catacritic again, possibly.
Catacritic. Yeah. Containers for all sorts of unspeakable things, which are now allowed, but are still forbidden, mm-hmm. and are perverse in the enjoyment of their forbiddenness. And that's a. I think Calvary is a very dense work that has probably been dismissed because of its tone, which is very
It's something as stupid as the trailer sold it as a comedy that it wasn't trying to necessarily be. And if you watch those two trailers for it, it is sold as a comedy. And something as simple as that can destroy an entire audience seeing it.
Yeah. Like, well, some comedian on my Facebook wrote like something like, I saw that Calvary, it's supposed to be a black comedy. I didn't laugh once. Which, you know, it's the Irish comedian right there. You know, they could put it on your gravestone. You didn't laugh once because you're not fucking capable of it.
That's really, sorry. That is actually what my little understanding of the Irish comedy scene, that is kind of what it's like.
It's so true. Yeah. It's disgusting.
I didn't laugh once.
So moving to staging, I don't have a lot to say here, but except, you know, we talked about the black dog. There's also the gun. I think the gun on the stage is also it's ironic. It's a literal Hitchcockian. Oh, if the gun is above, I think Hitchcock literally said that if the gun is above the mantle in the first scene, and here we have a gun above the mantle in the first. So it's
he twists that in the rope and whatnot. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. So this is a very this is not the work of a naive author. This is someone who's very consciously subverting.
But it's a wink and a nod, and it turns out to be a very fun one. That it's part of the comedy.
Having your cake and eating it.
Yeah.
What else do we have? The cargo cult of religiosity is something I've written here, which is in reference to the crucifix and the pieces. So I suppose that ties into this these empty symbols as well. Mm-hmm. That the performance of religion is more important, and that's what Father Welsh doesn't understand, is that it's always been the performance of religion. Mm-hmm. Religion as community and as protection for the hidden catharsis of twisted sexuality.
Yeah.
It's never been about the actual religion.
And the acting out of possible redemption for those who fail and feel shame every day in their lives in the real practical sense. That's why the symbols that were being kept by Valine didn't matter, and the stove didn't really matter. But what did matter was the symbols that came from a relationship that happened, that acted out, that was heuristically there, which was between a man that they knew, a priest, a woman that they knew as well, who's now going to go mad, and their connection. Those two, that's why they're the only symbols that matter, is that letter. Yeah. And that necklace at the end, because those had a connection to them. They know in some way that they matter.
But in a way, a new cargo cult is being formed because they know they matter, but they don't really know why they matter. So they hammer them up against the wall. They try and burn them, and they'll probably tear them apart.
He hasn't burned yet, but it's starting on what's going to happen again, which is he's just going to make himself absent from it. It's just another stupid cargo cult. It's another empty symbol on the wall to represent some old faith. But I think hopefully for
golden
them,
golden calves.
Very good. It might also, though, be a ritual that will hopefully form some love between them. That's the hope you have, but you don't know. Like, in the end, it's not really about knowing, is it? It's not about it, is it?
It's about unknowing.
Exactly.
So we've talked about...
How was that conference?
it was excellent. Yeah. We've talked already about poverty, but there's also the poverty of emotions and the absence of generosity of spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're hidden. The love is there, but the love is in their respite and they're attacking one another, I think.
That's what Father Welsh thinks. I'm not so sure.
No, definitely. For me, that's the only way they know how to connect. Otherwise, they would have killed each other way earlier.
I agree. That's the way they know how to connect. But I don't know if it's a loving way. It's loving in the sense that
maybe we're both dubious about how we decide what love is. Maybe for me, that's just... You know.
Well, if the other weren't there, Valine and Coleman would be bereft. But I don't know if it's because they would miss the other. I think they might miss what they do for the other. What the kind of a mutual cycle of abuse that they can engage in.
Here we are. We're back onto the name of the Lonesome West again. Is it more that they're frightened of their own aloneness and not so much caring of their actual characters? And that's a definite question that goes up. Because, I mean, right at the end, when they're starting to maybe have a moment of they're conferring, they're agreeing, and there's possible burgeoning of a chemistry here, he does say, well, you know, I'd really miss you if you were gone. But he says it in a kind of a quixotic way, and he's still angry. And it's almost like saying, well, I'd just be back to the whole concept of alone again, which is I'm not ready to be. So you wonder, is it that they're frightened of loneliness?
And is it also this trap that they're in? Is it Stockholm Syndrome? Mm-hmm. Is any affection that they have towards each other, is it purely kind of the affection of people trapped together in mutual loathing, forming this kind of contemptible false love?
Yeah. I don't know. If it's Stockholm Syndrome, it's obviously asymmetric. It bounces both ways at all times. And I don't know. I do think that there is, in the passion and fervor they have for attacking one another, that is the way they convey their love and effect on one another. The other one can affect the other one so easily. And there is a great truth to the Irvin D. Allen Rollo May conception of hate is not the opposite of love. It's just on the spectrum. It mirrors love. If you can really attack and feel so much from someone's tiny words, usually mean nothing out of context, but now they do, that does mean you have connection. You have investment. There's something there.
That's true. And they're vehemently incapable of feeling anything for anyone else, because there's lots of great bits like that. This bit where they're reading one of the women's magazines and there's a Bosnian armless orphan
who's
one parent has just died, and they're it's tragic, and then they read they're only after the feckin' money Jesus Christ, you know, who needs the money more?
Don't they actually debate that as well, who does need the money more?
Yeah, not going to do it. What's he going to do with the money now? He's no arms, no parents.
Yeah.
Waste of money.
That's got to be something that we come away from this place saying, though, that for whatever about the enjoyment on the analysis layer, we don't know how much we can take from it. Some of it we've established, some of it, well, maybe there isn't much more, and some of it's projected, but it was so much fun to read and that it was funny.
It is very funny.
It's very funny.
And that's the great liberty of McDonagh, is that he doesn't feel the need to be taken seriously, and he is taken seriously precisely because he doesn't feel the need to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. That's really good in old Europe, you know, in a theatre context, which is so much about being taken seriously.
Yeah,
as a representative of a generation, as the voice of a movement, or as a great thinker and conveyor.
It's a level of honesty, and I use the word level because there's different forms of honesty in everything that we do, and in curating a work like a piece of theatre, just like how Louis C.K. manages to have fantastic comedy because of his amazing honesty and how he delivers that honesty, it's a level of honesty that only great playwrights can get. And sometimes, I'm not saying it's innate, but I think there's some things that just happen to be at that age of his life, there's some things that happen to be there to help him be really honest. And it's brilliant. Like, again, like, you take Tarantino. If anyone else but Tarantino wants to do the kind of Tarantino work that Tarantino does, said his name a lot there, it'd be shit.
It'd be exploitative.
It'd be shit and exploitative and pulp and the worst part of pulp. But when he does it, it's because he doesn't need you to really like it. I mean,
as Darren McManus is the critic, the literary critic, or one of the literary critics for the Irish Independent, said recently, you know, people used to say in the 1990s that Rodriguez was another Tarantino, but Rodriguez is still making Rodriguez films. Mm-hmm. And Tarantino has made films, mm-hmm. real films. And that's, you know, it's the difference. That's the Tarantino without the soul is Rodriguez. Which is a ludicrously pretentious thing to say.
Yeah, that is.
I apologize.
But look, that's the world we're in. We're reviewing plays and we don't have... Well, you're about to make a play, in fairness to you. You are a creator. You are going to make one.
Well,
soon.
We'll see if it ever happens. But...
Yeah, I have a lot of hope in it. A lot of hope.
Thank you. It's an empty symbol floating in the void. So there goes
my investment.
The world of Linnan, we talked about this a lot, but this is a place where men are arrested for screaming at nuns. We get acts of murder and horrendous violence routinely committed and routinely ignored. And it's a dispirited place where...
But all the front-end characters matters. Beside Welsh, though, are the ignorers. They are the ones acting only on pathological forces, just gone way beyond them. Pathetic ritual and empty vessel ideas and a pathology of just do this because that's the football team, just do that. The will isn't there so much as the will to stay alive and ignoring of any real exigent thing, because the feelings are so at this point, you know, they're only death and hurt and aloneness. So if you think about the three people who are saying the things that they're saying, such as Gurleen, Feline and Coleman, that we never actually see the other characters who are having real feelings, who are feeling aloneness and killing themselves and going through the process of realizing the emptiness and choosing death. We never see them. We never really hear them. The only one we do get access to is Welsh himself, who in experiencing these three characters ultimately decides on death. And while it is a sacrifice, you have to also think that these people kind of pushed him into it.
Well, I see this place as it's, you know, children raised in a very abusive context or neglected or raised by animals, mm-hmm. become... grow up incapable of speech, and there's a lot of ethnographic studies on how they're kind of misformed. And Ireland,
not quite Joseph Rupert, but the wild children and the French,
exactly. And Ireland at this point in time is a country which is becoming reflexive in a way for the first time as a society. Individual mm-hmm. Irish people have always been very reflexive and often left or like become alcoholics, like Flann O'Brien. But we get the society becoming reflexive, and in being reflexive, in getting this light shed on itself, the darkness becomes apparent. Mm-hmm. The horror. And it's still, writers to this day are still tackling this fragile knowledge, which led to, people talk about the plummeting attendance in churches. It wasn't because of abuse. That's a complete misapprehension. The if you look at when the attendance in mass started falling away, it was before all of the revelations. And in fact, the revelations only came out because we were in a society that could tolerate those revelations.
It was the opening up of media channels.
Exactly.
And it was enlightenment, essentially.
Yeah, TV from outside of Ireland being the main thing, and of course the internet as well. And this floodlight of earnest awareness in a new generation growing up, realizing, and I often talk about the double generation gap between myself and my parents. My parents are like people's parents who grew up in the 60s. They're like people of the 40s. They're so entrenched, are they, in the belief systems of Catholic Ireland, mm-hmm. and the illusions of that. And that generation, their generation, is still struggling with the downfall of their faith in the church in a way that seems absurd.
Well, we struggle with apathy.
Well, we struggle with that. Well, we always knew it was like this. This is because that's what we grew up in. We grew up in this Tarantino world. And but there's writers even today. Graham Tugwell is a horror writer who's quite active in Dublin. And his world that he's created, I don't know if he's directly influenced by McDonagh, but it's a very similar grotesque Irishness. And Darragh McClelland is another great Irish writer, kind of emerging at the moment. His short stories also depict this kind of surrealistic hell, this Swim Two Birds kind of land beyond the land, which is the truth of Ireland beyond all of the lies and religion and GAA.
It's risen to a mythic form, but at the same time you're giving it that spectral dynamism that only theater and film can give, but it is at the same time the exigent grand forces that were at play that no one talked about, but now we're focusing on them. This is the great highlight. This slice of film will make you experience it at its peak.
It's almost like Philip K. Dick in the sense that psychosis or psychedelics or a disenchantment, which is almost psychotic, allows you the gap in which to look back and see the horror of the machine of society,
as well as your own demons as well. That is that which is repressed, whether you liked it or not. Those things that will always fall to repression, and every age has a different thing to repress, so we'll always have a different thing to look back on.
And right now we're seeing a whole load of new shibboleths being created, but let's not get ourselves burned at the stake just yet. So violence. This is a very violent play. You've got the violence of language, but there's a lot of different kinds of violence. I'll give you my violence list here, so it's not
Yay.
To bogart the discussion of violence.
It's all right.
What have we got in terms of violence?
I look like bogart anyway. Let's see. Violence. Offstage revelations. The murder capital of feckin' Europe. Patricide. Matricide. Extreme animal cruelty. Cat kick dogs. Dog's ears clip, I should say. Suicide. Tom Hanlon. Spousal murder. Attack on Coleman's object of affection by Valentine. Retribution. Verbal violence. Fraternal comedic brawling. Violence done to the spirit by the failure of society. Violence as communication games people play. And cartoonish violence. And envy. Fraternal and destructive. So, yeah.
So like Tarantino, I think there's a separation between the true violence, which all occurs off stage, mm-hmm. or most recently in what's the slavery movie?
Django Unchained.
Django Unchained.
Django.
Tarantino said that he the violence which occurs towards African Americans in the film is real. The violence which occurs towards white characters is fantastical, and they're shot differently.
It's revenge fantasticalism. Yeah.
And in this play, all of the true violence, like horrific things, like the dog's ears being cut off and bleeding to death, the suicide of Tom O'Hanlon, the suicide of Father Welch, it all occurs off
stage. And that is the very real. That's what I was trying to bring up earlier. That's the reality of bleak suicide, but no numbers, no register. Kind of let's overlook it. What am I trying to say here? Essentially, the forgotten, the deliberately forgotten parts of Irish violence.
And there's only one moment where real violence occurs on stage, which is the moment when Father Welch plunges his hands into the liquid magma of this molten plastic
of saints
and screams. And in the screams, we get not to get too Zizekian, but we get the incomplete partial object of David Lynch. We get the separation of voice, of the persona.
He delays for 15 seconds, which is part of that.
Sustained. And there's that great moment in Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, that's what you're referring to, which is the voice separates separated. From the woman. Yeah. Yeah, in the opera house. Yeah.
And these are of a time. I think Mulholland Drive came out either the same year or maybe a year after this, or a year before. I don't know, I'm grasping at something here, but there is something interesting about Irishness in that. Maybe it's the deprivation of the
signifier
voice.
And the signified have been separated, or one is lost in the other. More importantly, maybe all that's left is the signifiers, and we're trying to search for ourselves either as a signified or the thing as a signified. We have no idea. Little S cannot find big S.
You can see in that scream, you can see the scream of the voiceless, of all of this horror that we constantly talk about.
This is something we'll have to talk about in more, and hopefully we'll keep this as a pattern, but this is why, to this day, one of my greatest directorial heroes will be Stanley Kubrick, because he's managed to use the best of his films as a kind of a symbolic waiting ground for the screams of historical repressed and raped people who've never gotten to scream. He represents the ab reaction of the dead that they could never have. And we know this because of the intro sequence even of The Shining, which is the same thing here, which is that if you listen to the intro sequence, you're hearing not just the the Sioux Indians doing their loud howling tribalistic scream, which they do at funerals, but you're also hearing the screams of women and men and potentially recordings from those of the Holocaust. You're hearing the whole of human history screaming at you in what is just a scene of a camera floating over a large mountainscape. But in that mountainscape, there is the death and buried history of the dead that didn't have their say. The ahistorical, the beyond history.
And of course, Kubrick was working on a Holocaust film, which because of Schindler's List, he didn't release. But he famously said that Schindler's List is not about the 6 million that dead, it's about the 200 that lived, or whatever, the 1,000 that lived. And that's what makes it, while it's still a great film, flawed masterpiece.
And we know, just like with his set direction, which is sometimes was a bit too direct and other times incredibly subtle, he was trying to make a Holocaust point a little bit, even in The Shining. Something as stupid as having a lot of suitcases behind people that represent the left behind goods and the
and all the imagery of the Indian, like the Indian soup and the Indian products,
And then repressed history being blood behind a door creeping out, the blood of the millions that we don't recognize or no longer have or we pretend isn't there.
And even if we can tie it into video games, in The Darkness,
I'll keep going, we're on a roll.
that's a game which addresses the First World War, which of course this is the centenary of the First World War. Mm-hmm. That game, in the same way, connects. There's a limbo level where you're meeting all these characters that have been trapped from the First World War. It's a literal thing, but it's a video game. They can only do so much. You meet these characters who become lost and pulled out of time by the sheer horror of what they've experienced. And maybe just because I'm listening to Dan Carlin at the moment and he's going through the litany of horrors at the gases and Thermopylae and all of these.
In his coffee sipping, funny, kind of Americanized. It's a great morning for a podcast.
Backwards baseball cap, yeah. Stefan Molyneux face on him.
In his churlishly happy way, just reading off a list.
But I've disappeared down a rabbit hole.
This has been enjoyable, though. I think this is a pattern enjoyable. We'll return to, which is the unspoken, the signifier lost of the many dead and many killed, the parts of history that aren't recorded. Because if there's one meta great nihilistic concept that came up in the 90s, it's the recognition that true history is only framed in the historicization of now. You only frame history on what you see now. And if that is true as a conception of how consciousness works, then perhaps there's so much history that's lost, but yet only exists in some human form, and that it's below consciousness, which is an awareness that there's so many dead. We don't quite know who they are or where they are, but we just know it happened.
The historicity of McDonough will be our book coming out from
McMillan. We should make a Kubrickian film. Be incredible. It would just be a total rip on Kubrick, though.
So unoriginal and obvious would it be.
What are you talking about? No one's ever done that.
So kind of the last section of thoughts I have here, just quickly to go through them,
shoot,
is on the humor of the play. Mm-hmm. And it is, as you say, it's a very funny play, but it's funny in a lot of interesting ways. There isn't one kind of humor. For example, Oscar Wilde, the great Irish wit, essentially has one mode of humor, and it is the humor of misunderstanding, verbal misunderstandings and actual misunderstandings, the tradition of farce. Mm-hmm. And it's beautifully witty. But McDonagh here uses so many different modes. We have these kind of linguistic literalisms that we talked about, malapropisms, the brothers reading women's magazines, never explained why they have this passion for women's magazines. It seems to be totally desexualized.
Yeah.
The Welsh misnomer.
Yeah, well, that consistently reoccurs its ugly head right from the start, and I never quite understand.
I don't get what it means either.
Yeah, maybe
it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Maybe he meant to flesh it out later. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just the pragmatics of writing are such that not every thread leads anywhere.
I think
anywhere.
I did understand a little bit of it. It's partly the depersonalization. It's that the Welsh Walsh could never be matched.
Even the girl who supposedly loves him doesn't know his name.
It doesn't really know who
Which
he is.
Which is it? Father Welch or Welsh, she says. Yeah. So there's a lot of irony and the classic misunderstandings of Catholicism or correct misunderstandings. The good thing about being Catholic, you can shoot your dad in the head and it doesn't even matter at all, as Kaufman says.
I recall that now.
It's one of the many better things about being Catholic. And all of this stuff, the a lot of inanity as well. Tatoes are dried fecking filth and everyone knows they're great reference to the Irish debate over the quality of crisps which at this point in history, we might add, we're not foil wrapped and hence we're of a much lower quality. Tato today is a fantastic brand of crisp. And the girl born in Norway with no lips, and the alias Smith and Jones, one of them suiciding.
But the hilarious introduction of meaningless public, like just common stories, stories of interest. That level of news and pop and glitz and nonsense in magazines that was coming through in
and this
boring,
is a world,
stimuli form.
This is the last moment of a world before the internet as well, where you could go, he's not fecking dead. Look, I'll Google him. That might seem like a out of left field reference, but it's I think it's important differentiation because this is a world of myth. This is a world where somebody can genuinely believe that it says in the Bible, you should share and share alike, or somewhere it says, you know.
Yeah. Although those misconceptions can still happen too.
They can still happen, but at least we can correct them.
Yeah, we can pull out our iPhones. And
but there's a firmness now in the
prudent about it.
There, in what Rancière would call the hegemony of explication.
Hegemony of explication. What the? Everything's a fucking hegemony to the French.
Sorry, that's a call back to that Pedagogics conference.
Yeah.
So that we got all of these different modes of humor, and they're used to deracinate the violence so as to make it tolerable, but also to utterly undermine the mythos of the Irish theatre. And that's where I would like to, that's where I want to nail that. That's why McDonagh is worthwhile, because you can critique him for being trivial, and you might be right on some level, but it needed to be done. It needed to be done.
Yeah,
this dismissal, this dismissal of the importance of the theatre.
It's always a first, and he had to be.
And it's a people's theatre. What he makes here, it's a people's theatre. It's you can imagine you could put this on in any school in Ireland or England or America, and the students would be rolling in the aisles.
Yeah.
It's got everything.
It's quite universal. It's very funny.
Give
in fact, it was so universal it went to Broadway. Give her
big bazoobas. Everybody will watch the movie.
Make it a corset. Yeah. Make her Keira Knightley for some reason.
Oh, God, no. She has the...
I think she's perfect for that because she'd get it so wrong. She'd just be terrible at it. That's kind of what
that's such a pretentious thing.
I think
she's
so
perfect
beautiful.
Because she's so wrong.
Yes,
for
it's the anti-role.
Oh, God. And the final kind of humor that struck me is the adolescent prejudice. You know, they talk. There's that great conversation they have about magic carpets and levitating like the darkies.
Yeah,
and then they're arguing
the sand darkies and the
they're not darkies. They're packy men. Yeah. Same as
whistle. You know all about the packy men. I do. I'm an expert on
the packy men. The same as whistle at the snakes. You know, that's
I loved that saying. Whistle the same as pulling the teeth out of goats. It's just the excellent. Sayings they have. Those are real phrases that were passed around by that kind of consciousness at the time.
So let me ask you one question, because it's just occurring to me reading that. I could see someone critiquing this play as being condescending to the poor or the uneducated or the working class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you live in a world where you believe quote unquote packy men whistle at snakes,
or that you're the expert on packy men,
you're in a remarkably diminished condition. Mm-hmm. And is McDonagh laughing at these people, or is he explicating the terror and horror of their existence?
He couldn't be, because the real people are behind the scenes dying and in some ways admitting their pain in a way that we can barely attach symbolically to, but that is there. They've walked into a river and disappeared. They've cried their last scream and then went off to death, or they've managed to be killed by their loved ones that seem to go every day to church and have a great laugh with the priest. They're, even though that's slightly comedic, most of it's not. It's a sad reality that he quite consistently makes reference back to. That these are people behind the scenes that suffer in the world that these two, in a weird way, not succeed in, but love to be in. They love their hate. This is a kind of acceptance of their position. So no, if there wasn't those characters dying in the background, potentially you could make it out to be a diminutive, scathing writing up of the pop, let's say the pop poor of Ireland, the perfunctoriness of their existence, of arguing over Tato and such cheap things like that. But no, because of that backdrop, absolutely not. I don't think so at all. And those are his characters. And what, I know that's a stupid thing to say, but think about what I mean there. Those are people he spent a lot of time, don't believe the story he said in 3 weeks, he spent a lot of time creating. No one just creates characters to make an insulting jibe. Poor people. I mean, no one really makes great theatre about that. It just doesn't happen. This is, you know, there's so much happening with them. It couldn't just be one commentary. And I certainly don't think if there is a commentary in there, it's one about poor people being stupid. Not at all. It's about the kind of character, the malformed character that comes about in an environment like the destitute West, impoverished Ireland. And that's, look, I mentioned, if you want to go to someone who celebrates it, Brian Friel talks about very similar things. Not at all. Don't think it's an insult. No, I think you can be insulted, but that's not the intention, was not to insult.
And on that, we will leave the Lonesome West to rot, as indeed it has. And next week we'll be discussing the Baltimore Waltz.
Oh, yay.
And we have a couple of actors who have recently performed in it.
I'm scared of other people. I don't want to compete. I'm scared.
A couple of lovely people who have recently...
Is one of them... What? Who are they?
Well, yes, one of them is a girl.
Excellent. So we'll be back on Sunday, is it? Or
look at you, virgin gay boy.
Well, every Tuesday on Radio Maid, isn't it?
Hopefully, every Tuesday on Radio Maid, and for the longer, thicker production.
Fortune Messenger production.
Connect to the interweb for this extended. How long has this been? Let me gaze at her. 2 hours.
Sorry, we're very tired.
I'm cutting that out. 2 hours.
No, you're keeping it.
2 hours this has been. 2 hours.
Two hours. Wonderful.
My God.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. Good night.
Bye-bye.